Get started here. Is that mic working? I can kind of hear it. All right. My name is Ben Lauder. I'm the vice chair. Chris is our chairman. He's running late tonight, so I'll be leading the meeting until he gets here. Let's go ahead and do, first of all, welcome. Thank you for coming. We've got a pretty good sized audience tonight. That's good to see. Let's go ahead and run through some rack introductions. Start to my left with AJ. Go ahead and introduce yourself and who you represent.
AJ Maurer, Agriculture.
Joshua Leonard, Sportsman's.
Steve Lund, County Commissioner.
Ken Strong, Sportsman's.
Mike Christensen at large.
Jason Vernon, Division of Wildlife Resources, the Regional Supervisor.
Again, I'm Ben Lauder, Public at Large.
Brock McMillan, Sportsman.
Paul Gaucher, U.S. Forest Service.
Dan Potts, Non-Consumptive.
Chris Schmitz, Non-Consumptive.
Alan White, Agriculture.
All right. excuse me. I see some familiar faces, a lot of new faces, so I'm going to go over the procedures of how the RAC meeting will go forward tonight. And I don't have a copy of the procedures, but I think I probably know them fairly well. Essentially, we will each agenda item will have a presentation from somebody from the Division of Wildlife Resources, after which we will take questions from the RAC first, correct? And then after RAC questions, we will take questions from the audience. During that time, it is a period for questions and questions only, not comments. After we have filled out all the questions, we will move on to the public comment portion. If you want to make a comment, there are yellow comment cards on the table over there next to the doors you came in. Fill out one of those with your name information and the agenda item number that you would like to address the RAC for, and submit that up to us, and we'll go through public comments at that time. You'll be limited to 3 minutes for public comment. After we receive public comments, we'll hear RAC comments and RAC discussion and entertain motions and votes. So that's how we'll proceed. We'll start off with an approval of agenda and minutes. Has everybody had a chance to look over the agenda and seen the minutes from the previous meeting? If there's no discussion or comments, I'd entertain a motion. Okay, motion by Ken.
I'll second it.
And a second. All right. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Perfect. All right. Moving on. Wildlife Board meeting update. What was the last Wildlife Board meeting? Was that the Bears? I believe. The Bear meeting. And I don't have notes from that. Do you? I think I attended that meeting, but I wasn't prepared to give an update.
I don't have much from that. We see that now either.
And our wildlife board members aren't here. I don't see Darren here. There was a Bear Wildlife Board meeting. Things happened. How about we come back to that? Okay. All right. I'll turn it over to you for a regional update.
All right, I'll be really brief on our regional update. Make sure we have time to get through our meeting this evening. Really, the only thing I want to mention is from the wildlife side. As far as the winter that we've had this year and deer survival throughout the state, basically from the central region south has been good survival, and then the top third of the state has not been so good. So we're fortunate in the central region to have good survival this year. One of the things our biologists are working on now are spring let counts for sage grouse. So they'll be out doing that. And then some spring range rides and classifications as well. And Mr. Chair, I think I'll just leave it right there in the interest of time. So Thank you.
I was hoping you would take more time. I was trying to look up the minutes from the board meeting. All right. Any questions from the regional update? Okay. We're moving along quickly. Great. We're on to item number five. Covey, you're up. Big game and draw applications, rules, and amendments. I hope you're more prepared than we were.
All right. Thanks, Ben. Okay. It's exciting to see some BYU students here. Hope we get some questions. Okay. All right, with that, we'll go into the taking big game, drawing applications, and procedures. These are rule changes for two different rules. R657-5, which is taking a big game, and 657-62, which are drawing procedures. Starting with taking big game, the first rule, we realized we had some conflict in how we managed the depredation program and the big game program, and that is that in depredation situations, sometimes we need individuals to be able to harvest more than one pronghorn a year. But the big game rule prevented that. And so this rule change allows a person to have more than one pronghorn permit a year in a depredation situation when a landowner is trying to solve a problem or we're trying to work with the landowner to solve a problem. The next change we're recommending in taking big game is bighorn sheep. This last year, we worked really hard to write a new bighorn sheep statewide management plan. And one of the key pieces of that plan is that we provide more protection to our bighorn sheep and to our producers. You know, in Utah, we've taken a different approach in that the Division of Wildlife is not looking to eliminate sheep producers on the landscape. We want to work with producers. And so in order to do that, one of the things that we need to do, I'm on the wrong slide here. I'll explain it, go back to this one. In order to do that, one of the things that we need to do is allow producers to be able to take bighorn sheep when they're in their flocks. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, it protects the bighorns that we have on the landscape. So if a bighorn gets in with domestic sheep, a producer can take that sheep. Then when he does that, that sheep can't get back to our bighorn herds and hurt those herds. Also, it protects his operation on the landscape in that he reduces his risk of transmitting disease to bighorn sheep. So the way that we do that is authorize a certificate of registration. They would apply for it and say, I have an allotment within an area where I'm worried that bighorns could get in with my sheep. We'd review it and then approve it. If they take a bighorn within their domestics, they have to notify the division within 24 hours. And all parts, pieces, head, horns, and cape would then become part of the division to donate, use for educational purposes or whatever else. The one that I skipped. We had to clarify, for bighorn sheep, we've managed them differently in the big game rule. And in differently in that we manage them as separate point systems. But for having a permit, we've said that you could only have one permit for bighorn sheep a year, which is inconsistent with the rest of what we do. So this clarifies that a hunter may have one, but only one, desert bighorn and Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep permit in the same year. The other change we're recommending is to be able to call a new type of hunt. And this is a handgun archery muzzleloader hunt. If you remember last fall, we had a push from constituents, from some of our constituents said, we want to see more primitive weapon type hunts. We want to see a hunt that goes backwards instead of forwards. Now rifles can shoot, 800 yards proficiently. We have muzzleloaders that will shoot 600 yards proficiently. And we want to see something that moves the dial back. And we heard that, and we said, we don't have anything to do that with. We don't have a mechanism or a way to do that. And so we're proposing this rule change to the handgun archery muzzleloader. It prohibits the use of scopes. It defines a pistol for the purposes of this hunt. So it defines a pistol differently. And we did that intentionally to eliminate. There are some new pistols that have it's a pistol with an AR, and this would prohibit most of those the way that we define this. And it requires hunters to meet the criteria for any legal weapon other than that. So it's a hunt with no scopes. This isn't currently in any management plans, So this is just laying the groundwork. If it were a tool that we wanted to use in the future now, we could. And finally, youth-only group applications. This ensures that youth-only group applications. So we had an inconsistency in that youth couldn't apply as a group or antlerless permits. And this recommendation makes it so that youth can apply as a group for antlerless permits. That's it. And that's all.
Colby? The youth that comply as group is only for antlerless, not the regular?
So it was always, youth could always apply for a group for bucks and bulls and the other hunts, but they couldn't apply as a group in antlerless and be considered as a youth-only group. So this change just makes it so that the percentage of permits that we allocate when they apply as a group in youth, they remain eligible for that percentage of permits. If that makes sense.
The change on the Desert Bighorn and Rocky Bighorn being able to obtain more than one permit per year, is that, who's that going to affect? Is that just like going to affect auction tags, or
mostly conservation permit holders?
Overlay the expo a little bit. Is that what it's after?
Mostly conservation permit holders. It could affect out-of-state residents. So mostly auction tags. Yep.
Any other questions from the rack? Go ahead.
Just one more question. As far as being able to take a Desert Bighorn or a Rocky Mountain Bighorn as a permittee,
as a producer,
what's the timeline in there for approval for that certificate? If somebody goes out on the desert or out on the Mineral Mountain and sees one there.
So they would have that. So the way that I see this being implemented is that they would know I'm headed to my winter allotment or summer allotment, and they would apply for that before they even went. So when they went out on their allotment or even on their private property, they would have that certificate of registration in hand.
So they don't have to have a visual before they apply for it.
No, we would evaluate, and the division would reserve the right to evaluate each individual circumstance and say, is it warranted here, is it not, and work with that producer to make sure we have the best possible outcome. But no, they would have it before. I should mention that we did send this back out to the committee, which included wool growers, and we had wool growers, sportsmen, Department of Ag, and we had a lot of support with doing it this way with everybody. And I mean, everything we do is complicated, right? We're government. But we hope this is navigable.
Okay, if there's no other questions from the rack, we'll move to questions from the audience. Is there any questions from the audience on this agenda item? All right, seeing none, I have no comment cards. Have we received any comment cards yet? Okay, if you want to comment on this agenda item number 5, please fill out a comment card. They're over by the door, and bring them up to the front here. Ridley, go ahead and step up to the mic, and you have 3 minutes to make your comments.
Thank you. My comment is on the handgun.
Please state your name first.
Ridley Griggs, Provo, Utah, representing myself. My comment is on the handgun archery muzzleloader hunts. I'd like to request that the RAC consider a couple possible additions or modifications, one being shotguns. There are already archery shotgun muzzleloader hunts used in the antlerless draw, and they seem to work well. I've enjoyed the opportunity to use a shotgun on one of those tags. I think that could reasonably be added to the rule. While still preserving its intent. Another thing I'd like you to consider is potentially allowing a one power scope on these firearms. Some of us have a hard time focusing on a target and a front sight and a back sight all at once. once again, I think the integrity and the intent of the rule could be preserved while using a one power scope. Just want you to consider that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Apologies for being late. I'm Chris Marble. I'm the RAC chair. And thank you, Ben, for starting the meeting. Public comments portion? That was the only card. Okay. All right. All right. Well, let's bring it back to the RAC for any comments or motions.
Could Kobe speak to the idea of using a shotgun, open sight shotgun, as a part of that?
You're putting me on the spot, Ben, but you know, I can't think of a reason why that wouldn't meet the spirit of what we're trying to accomplish here.
Who was the committee that put together this proposal?
We formed a committee with a sportsman, a board member, and some division employees. A very small committee looked at this and then completely trashed everything we came up with when we brought it back, because it was complicated, and we're always swinging the pendulum towards opportunity and complication. And we brought it back and we just looked at what other states had. Arizona already has a hunt like this. It's something that's familiar for people, individuals that hunt Arizona. And we brought it back. And then I took that idea back to the committee and said, hey, does this accomplish what we're trying to accomplish? Is this? And they said, yeah, that will work.
And what are you trying to accomplish, Kobe? I'm not clear what this adds to what's already available.
Yeah, I think what it's trying to accomplish is provide an opportunity for folks that want to hunt a possibly, what we're trying to accomplish, Brock, is, and this is hard to say, I guess, is to provide more opportunity with lower success. You know, you take scopes off guns and it's harder to hit, harder to shoot. Takes your range way down. And so see if that provides more opportunity. That was the thought process.
I think the last comment you made really gets at it, is reducing the capable range, right?
Reducing the capable range.
But like, that's kind of the intent from what SFW brought last fall, and I think what you're trying to accomplish with this.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you know, the division, here's the big secret. I know I've heard of us dropping flour sacks out of helicopters and all sorts of stuff that sounds super fun, but at the end of the day, we really want hunters to be successful. And so that's why it's hard to say that the intent of this is to possibly reduce success and in doing so provide more opportunity.
One question. So you're talking slug.
Yeah, okay. I'm good with it.
Kobe, just another question for you. When this was first proposed last fall, I think I remember them saying something to the effect of the muzzleloader being not just scopeless, but like a sort of stripped down, no inline primer. Some of that language fell out, and I just wonder why scope was the only reduction. And because I think they were advocating for more traditional, like percussion cap or flintlock.
They were. And the reason why it fell out is because when we took it back and evaluated it, we wanted to reach the most hunters we could.
Right.
And so a lot of hunters have a muzzleloader already, and they just pull it out of the closet and pull the scope off. But I know a lot of hunters have gotten rid of their old sidelocks or flintlocks or just don't use them anymore. And so we didn't want to create a hunt designed, again, around a specific constituency that was small. We wanted it to be as broad as it could.
Oh.
A lot of hunters have a pistol that would qualify under this. A lot of hunters have a shotgun that would qualify under this, or a muzzleloader that would qualify. And so they don't need to go buy new weapons. They can just go hunt. And it's not targeted specifically to archery. You know, that's one of the accusations we get a lot at this division, is we cater to archers. Well, we don't try to cater to archers. We just know that we can provide more opportunity in archery because it's less effective.
All right. So then just to follow up on the comment that was made, it seems like a rifled slug with open sights would satisfy the spirit of the same
on idea. A shotgun?
Yeah.
I don't see a reason why it wouldn't.
No. Thanks.
I do think, though, the other comment was on 1X scopes, and I'm a little torn on that, but I think I like the rule written as is, with no scopes at all. And the reason for that is a 1X scope is still easier to shoot than iron sights, and you can get a 1X scope with a turret. And I think that goes against the intent of what this rule is trying to do.
Any other discussion? Have a motion?
This, we're not creating a hunt. We're just creating an avenue to possibly have a bring that forth to us next or this fall or next fall. Or.
Yeah, I think that the next step would be, if this is a strategy that we want to use to hunt, it would be to get it in a management plan.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But we didn't have it in rule, and so we felt like in order to do that, we'd need it in rule first. Ben?
Yeah, I'd be willing to make a motion. I move that we accept the division's recommendations as presented, with one exception, and that is that we add shotguns, slug shotguns, to the rule as well.
Can so it becomes a sham hunt.
Yeah, I second that.
Okay.
Okay, so motion made by Ben, seconded by Dan. Any more discussion?
Go ahead, Mike. I was going to say,
okay.
I'm not comfortable with defining what the shotgun would be as us, because I've shot a lot of deer with buckshot, and it is legal. And so, you know, I don't know that we need to use the word slug, because there's already a definition for war.
That's fair.
That's fair.
Okay, I'll amend my motion to accept the division's recommendations as presented, with one exception, and that we add shotguns to the list. Is that okay?
Okay, any other discussion on that before we vote?
Is there a second?
Yeah, Ken. Second. Ken and
Danny will be with Danny.
Yeah. I know I'm short.
We'll have to arm wrestle for it. Okay, any other discussion on that? Okay, all in favor? Any opposed? That was unanimous. One count. All right. Moving on. You're up, Kobe.
All right.
Bucks, bowls, and once in a lifetime.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. On to the 2019 Bucks and Bulls once in a lifetime permit recommendations. One of the things that this presentation or these presentations have always lacked is, how do biologists make permit recommendations? Where does that come from? And so, to provide a little background on how we make permit recommendations, I think the first thing we'd say is that herd health, but the biology and herd health come first. So we will never make a recommendation that will be detrimental to a population. Right? At times we want to reduce a population, right? We're talking bucks and bulls now, so that's not it. But we'll never make a recommendation that is detrimental. We're trying to manage that population. After that, a lot of the recommendation really is social. So there's always this pendulum between quality and opportunity. And we find ourselves asking all the time, who is right? You know, is it the individual that wants insane quality and isn't satisfied unless they're harvesting a 200-inch buck like Brock? Or is it somebody like me who's just okay missing a lot of deer and maybe getting a tiny one? And the truth is that there are a lot of right ways to manage wildlife, and they're both right. And so that's where we go into management plans. So when you see a recommendation, as you see the recommendations throughout this presentation, those recommendations are made to manage wildlife to a specific management plan. For deer, it's the mule deer management plan, or elk and moose and so forth. And the management plans are put together with a diverse group of constituents and then taken through the public process, where the public gets to put in their input on the management plans, and finally they're passed by the Wildlife Board, which then guides us in managing these populations. So as we make recommendations, again, we're managing to the management plan. So starting with the 2019 general season deer and limited entry permit recommendations. Looking at harvest this last year, it was a slight uptick. Again, the last 3 years have been really good for buck harvest in the state. In 2018, we were right there around 30,000 bucks that we harvested. Looking at our buck doe ratios and where we're at as far as the management objectives there, this excludes units that are dominated by private land. So this is just the public land units across the state. And that's because often on private lands, we're exceeding the buck doe ratios because we have a hard time harvesting the number we need to meet the objectives. And so on public land units across the state, we're right there at the top at 19 bucks per 100 does. So the very top of the guideline. Looking at fawn production trends, this dipped this last year, you know, at low 50s. And we like to see that number at about 60 fawns per 100 does, and that's one of the metrics we watch to see what a population is doing, and that's a little bit concerning. With that, we'll get right into the permit recommendations. So in 2018, we recommended 90,650 permits, or we had 90,650 permits, and in 2019, we're recommending 90,450. So no change on 15 units, an increase on 7 units, and recommending a decrease on 7 units. One more thing to keep in mind, this graph on the y-axis is the number of applications we receive annually. On the x-axis is the year up to current, 2018, and then forward projecting into the future. So you can see in 2007, we're issuing just over 90,000 permits, and we were meeting the demand. Or everybody that wanted to hunt deer in the state of Utah at that time had the opportunity to hunt deer. As we go on, we're increasing on average by about 7%, and we stopped meeting that demand in 2009 and haven't been able to meet it since. Again, issuing about 90,000 permits. And as we make these recommendations into the future, and in the spirit of general season hunting, we want to provide as much opportunity as we possibly can and still meet the management objectives. Starting with the northern region, the box elder, where we're exceeding there, we're not recommending an increase. We dropped this last year, and we recommended a healthy increase last year. And so we'll watch that another year. The Chalk Creek. Oh, thanks, Scott. The Chalk Creek East Kang and Morgan South Ridge. Again, we introduced that early rifle hunt there and had a healthy increase there. And the Camas as well. So no increases in the northern region, also no decreases. Onto the central region, we're exceeding the three-year average management objective for the Oaker Stansberries and recommending a slight increase there, and that's the only increase. On the southern region was portions of the southern region were more impacted by drought this last year, and we've seen it either a declining trend or where we've dropped below on the three-year average, and in both cases, we've made recommendations to adjust permits accordingly. So there in the Beaver, where we have a declining trend, we're still within a declining trend, we're recommending a decrease. On the Fillmore, again, this last year declined quite a bit, recommending a slight decrease there. The Monroe, we dropped below what we're managing for and recommending a decrease there. On the Dutton, with that declining trend, recommending a decrease. The Panguitch Lake, again, declining and below, recommending a slight decrease there. And then on the Pine Valley, as you can see, it's consistent at 24, and we have the ability to offer more opportunity on the Pine Valley, and we're recommending an increase there. southern region continued on the Plateau Fish Lake, slightly below, with a slight decrease. And the Plateau Thousand Lakes is an interesting one. The unit just isn't very big. And that's the reason why it has a hard time handling more hunters than that. So we're not recommending an increase there. The Southwest Desert, with a declining trend, recommending the same. And on the Zion, a slight increase there as we're quite a bit above and holding steady. Overall, a net decrease in permits in the southern region. About 5% or 1,075. And I didn't even explain the slide. Now I'm realizing I should have explained the slide better. Everybody's seen this a lot, but so on the very left-hand side, you have the unit and then what it's managed for. So we manage general season units for either 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does or 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does. There are two tiers within that. And then you see the last 3 years buck-doe ratios followed by the three-year average, last year's permit recommendations, or last year's permits, and then this year's permit recommendations. So in the southeastern region, on the 9 mile, again, this unit is dominated by private land, but we did implement that early season hunt and felt like we could offer a little bit more opportunity there, so recommending an increase. And on the San Juan Abajo, it clearly looks like it should recommend an increase. We've had some really poor fawn survival and harsh conditions down there. The droughts hit that area pretty hard, so recommending to stay the same. Overall, for the southeastern region, an increase of 100 permits. Under the northeastern region, recommending an increase on the north slope, where we're, again, at the very top end of the objective and have the ability to offer that opportunity. On the south slope, we're above the objective we managed there, 15 to 17. We're at 19, recommending an increase there. On the south slope, Yellowstone, also above, and recommending an increase there. Under limited entry, and just as a summary of limited entry by weapon type, recommending increases in all of the categories except for the late season muzzleloader. And that's because to qualify for one of these hunts, you must be in a unit that's managed for 18 to 20, a general season unit that's managed for 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does and exceeding that. And there were two units that fell out. And so that's the reason for the reduction there. And then on the management buck hunt, the reduction is on the Henrys, and I'll explain that as we go through. Overall, in limited entry deer hunting, we're recommending an increase of 14 permits or about 1% for 2019. So on to the Henry Mountains. This is the Henry Mountains, the regular permits, so not the management permits. And the plan states that these permits will remain consistent as long as 40% of the harvested bucks are at least 5 years old or older. And our three-year average for both is exceeding that, and our last year's is exceeding that 40%. So recommending 49 permits on the Henry Mountains and 135 permits on the Ponce Dump. Buck doe ratios on our premium limited entry units are managed a little differently, and they're managed with management buck permits. As we have on the Ponce Dump, we've remained relatively constant there. We manage them for 40 to 55 bucks per 100 does. We stayed right there between 51 and 49, and recommending to stay the same there. But on the Henrys, we've decreased our buck doe ratio. And so we're recommending to reduce permits and the management bucks to account for that. Also recommending to increase the Ponsagant cactus buck permits. This hunt was a success overall. The people that had the permit last year, most of them enjoyed it. The feedback I got was it was more difficult than they anticipated, but still a great hunt and a lot of fun on the Ponce Dump. Under our limited entry deer permit recommendations by unit, the Book Cliffs, starting with the Book Cliffs, as you see that, the Book Cliffs looks like it should trigger an increase in permits. However, we put collars out on the Book Cliffs this last year, and this was another area that was really affected by drought. We ended up just over 60% adult doe survival in the area. They had a really hard year, and that buck doe ratio might be more reflective of differential survival, possibly, than it is of an increase in the population. So we're recommending to stay the same there. Cache Crawford Mountain, that's a tiny unit in northern Utah there, recommending one permit increase. Fillmore Oak Creek Limited Entry, we're exceeding there and recommending an increase. Recommending a decrease on the north slope. And the reason for that is we also put collars out on the north slope this year. We're learning really interesting things from these collars. We've always thought that the deer on the north slope went north out into Wyoming, out into those flats when winter came. And what we learned is most of those deer go east towards Diamond Mountain. And so we're hunting the same deer in this early limited entry hunt and on the general season. So we increase permits in the general season. We're recommending a decrease in this hunt. San Juan Elk Ridge, we're exceeding there and recommending an increase. And then West Desert Vernon, also exceeding there and recommending an increase for an overall increase of permits. On the late season limited entry, there are no changes to this except for the what I mentioned before. The Monroe dropped below the manager's objective, and so it fell out. And the Plateau Fish Lake dropped below, and it fell out. So we're recommending 10 fewer permits from 172 to 162. When we talk about management plans and how we manage wildlife, in Utah we've decided to manage certain species to an average age of harvested animals. And we do that with elk, pronghorn, and moose. So we manage, and this is a photo from the BYU lab, and you can see it's an elk tooth, and you can see the cementum rings. So when we harvest an animal, they send a tooth in, they cut the tooth, they sand the tooth up, put it under a microscope, and then they're able to age the animal based on the cementum rings. Count them up. Pretty simple stuff. But it allows us to see what the demographics on the landscape are, how many animals we have harvested representative at different ages, and see where we are. So for elk, we manage units all the way from 4.5 to 8 years of age, and we break that up along the way. For pronghorn, we manage all pronghorn units for a 2 to 3 year old pronghorn, and then moose from 3.75 to 4.25 years old. Starting with elk, are recommending the same number of spike bull and any bull permits, 15,000. The statewide plan says that if the success rate ever gets above 20%, that we would reduce spike bull hunting, and we're not there. Even with the addition of the multi-season permit, we're still at 15% statewide harvest success on the spike bull hunt. So they set in the plan and recommended the same. Under 2019 limited entry elk recommendations by weapon type, recommending increases across all categories for a total of a 75 permit increase, or about 3% across the state. Starting with the older age class units, so these are the units that we manage for a 7.5 to 8 year old bull. These are the highest trophy quality units. The Beaver East, we're right there at the top of the age objective. The biologist felt like there's some room to offer a little bit more opportunity, recommending a slight increase there. The Book Cliffs Little Creek, we're below the management objective and recommending a decrease. The Plateau Boulder, Caparowitz, we're right there at the top end and probably have some room to offer a little bit more opportunity, so recommending an increase there. And the West Desert Deep Creek, we cut this pretty significantly over the last several years, and we're going to wait and see what that does over time. We're down to 20 permits. You've got to have a few elk harvested to know what the average age is. So on our 6.5 to 7 year old units, with the last year on the last 2 years on the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek being so low, recommending a decrease there. On the cache, with the three-year average being below the 6.5 to 7, recommending a slight decrease there. Central Mountains Nebo, again below that 6.5 to 7 year old, and recommending a decrease there. On the Monroe, we're within, but right at the top end, and the biologist feels like there's some room to offer a little bit more opportunity there. On the Dutton, below, and recommending a decrease, and on the Panguitch Lake, below, and recommending a decrease. South Slope Diamond Mountain, exceeding the objective and recommending increase there, and also on the Southwest Desert, exceeding recommended increase. Overall net decrease in the 6.5 to 7-year-old category, 22 permits. The 5.5 to 6-year-old units on the Central Mountains Manti were exceeding the age objective. Again, every year is exceeding, and the 3-year average is exceeding, so we're recommending an increase there. The 9-mile anthro, again, exceeding, recommending a significant increase there. North Slope's Three Corners, where we're below, recommending a decrease. The Ochre Stansberries, again, only have 20 permits on that unit and recommending to keep at least 20 permits on the unit. The Plateau Fish Lake, right at the very top end of what we're managing for and have the ability to offer some opportunity there. And then Wasatch Mountains exceeding the management objective and recommending an increase there. Overall net increase of 86 permits in the 5.5 to 6-year-old age class that we're managing for. And the 4.5 to 5-year-old in Box Elder Grouse Creek and Pilot Mountain, Box Elder Grouse Creek exceeding and recommending an increase. And the Box Elder Pilot Mountain is the one that probably stands out to most on the screen. We have a cooperative agreement with Nevada, and they got their permit recommendations in first. Our agreement says that we won't have more hunters than they have because we hunt both sides in Utah and Nevada, and we'll work more proactively on this one next year to make sure that we can provide more opportunity to our hunters. Cache Meadowville, at the very top end, and recommending a slight increase for an overall increase of 10 permits. On the Pronghorn, where we're managing for a 2 to 3-year-old average age buck in the harvest. I should mention here that the memo is incorrect. So the memo says, I believe it says 1,065, and it says 180 permit increase. It should actually be 178. The RAC packet and the PowerPoint are correct, but the memo is incorrect. But overall, recommending about a 20% increase across all weapon types for pronghorn. The 2019 once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations. And before we dive into those recommendations, just a quick reminder that we did write a new plan for mountain goats in the state this last year. The previous plan had a guideline in it that said that we could recommend permits to harvest 5 to 15% of the total counted population. The updated guideline changed that a little bit, and it recommended permits to harvest 5 to 25% of the counted adult population, so only adults. And so we have more flexibility. So the example, if you look at one of the units here, the beaver, we counted 110 adults. The total count was 139. The previous guideline would have been 7 to 20, and under the new guideline, the biologist can recommend 6 to 27. You can see the other examples. In bighorn sheep, the previous guideline was 12 to 15% of the counted rams, or 30 to 40% of the counted rams at least 6 years old or older. The updated guideline allows a biologist to recommend permits based on 12 to 25% of the counted rams, or 30 to 60% of the counted rams at least 6 years old or older. So again, the example being the Kaparowitz West there, counted 96 rams, 40 were at least 6 years old or older. The previous guideline would have allowed us to recommend 12 to 16 permits. Under the new guideline, we could recommend 12 to 24 permits. Strong sentiment in rewriting both of these plans that the public wanted more opportunity to hunt once-in-a-lifetime species, both sheep and mountain goats. And this allows us to do that. So with that, we'll go into the recommendations. Moose, recommending an increase in moose permits. We're above the average age that we're managing for and have that opportunity to offer. Bison, the 256 is including the 109 additional permits that we issued on the Henrys last winter when we had severe drought conditions. And so you're seeing a decrease there to 225. That decrease is primarily on the Henry Mountains. There is a significant increase on the Book Cliffs this year as that population has grown and coming into its population objective. On the bison archery permits, an increase in one permit there. There are two hunts this year, both a cow hunt and an either sex hunt for that. On desert bighorn sheep, recommending an increase from 56 to 66, and then the addition of three archery permits on the Zion. And in Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, recommending an increase there with four archery permits that'll be on the Newfoundland Mountains. Recommending a slight decrease overall in mountain goats. One of our strongest mountain goat herds is Box Elder, Northern Utah. What? Willard Peak. My mind just slipped. Willard Peak and the flight that came in this year on Willard Peak, and it was a good flight, showed that we were down a little bit there. So decreasing, recommending a decrease in permits there. And then recommending 14 archery permits with a new archery mountain goat hunt on the Nebo there. I will take any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Kobe. Any questions from the rack? No? Okay, we'll turn it over. Go ahead, Mike.
I have a question. So on the Nebo unit, can you go back to that limited entry slide on the elk?
Yes. Right there?
Yeah. So that's a 6.5 to 7-year-old unit. Since 2008, it's been the highest age objective it's ever, or average age it's ever had was 6.2. So that's 11 years of data. Is that a unit that should be at such a high age objective? I think we went from 150 tags 10 years ago, and now we're at 40 tags on that unit.
If we were to reopen the plan tomorrow, Mike, that's a discussion. That's one of the discussions that we would have is, does this unit really fit in the 6.5 to 7? Or is there, I mean, we're managing the largest elk unit in the state right next to its neighbor at 5.5 to 6.
Yeah.
And so is it really possible? I mean, what you're stating is absolutely accurate to even manage this at 6.5 to 7, or is there too much interchange? Yeah. And it seems like it would probably fit better in a 5.5 to 6 and be right alongside the Manti. Yeah. But it's not right now.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mike. Any other questions?
I have one question. Go ahead, Daddy.
Yeah, I had one. So I walked out for a second. So, Kobe, so, you know, with this catastrophic loss this year, especially fawns, and especially in northern Utah, I mean, there's deer laying dead everywhere. Either they got hit by cars or they're in the bottoms of draws, and, you know, it just looks bad. So how far out are we looking at compensating for that loss?
Yeah.
How many years out just you guys look? Two?
So, I mean, with general season units, really, you pick it up that next year.
Oh, okay.
A lot of times because, yeah, our general season units are primarily they primarily harvest yearling bucks or 2-year-old bucks, and so mm-hmm. often pick it up that next classification year when you come in, and then we can readjust from there. But we do know that post-season we had enough bucks on the landscape to provide a good hunt, and then we can readjust in the following year. And that's wildlife management. It's, I heard somebody say once, it's science, but it's not rocket science, right?
So my question, Kobe, you know what I'm going to say, I think, and that is, I don't get the Pine Valley and the Zion. I mean, you said in your introduction here, let me see what the words were, sure. We want to provide as much opportunity as we can and still meet the management objectives. I think those were your exact words. Both of those units are 4,000 deer over objective. Both of those units are chronically way over buck-to-doe ratios. And we recommend none or 100 or this year 300, which is awesome, new tags on the Paya Valley. I think that's a great movement if that happens. I don't know that that'll happen. But I don't get why we aren't using that resource.
Yes. So, I mean, we have recommended increases on the Pine Valley time and time again. And we know we have more opportunity to offer there. It's a lot of wildlife management is social, and there's a pretty strong constituency in southern Utah that likes it the way that it is. I think Kevin Albrecht said it best, though, last time when he was talking about everybody wanted unit-by-unit hunting, and he said, if unit-by-unit hunting is going to work in the state of Utah, all of the units have to play ball. And this is one that you can look back through the data and clearly see that they haven't wanted to play ball. And I get it. We all have our backyard. I'm pretty protective of where I hunt, too.
Thank you.
Not my recommendations, though.
Colby, don't we have a lot of private property on the Zion? And could that affect...
Yeah, there's a lot of private, but there's also a lot of access on the Zion, too. It's a good mix. It's not like a Chalk Creek or one of these units. It's all, but there is more private on the Zion, that's fair, than some of the other southern Utah units that are all public.
But success rate's still 43%, so it's not a big problem.
Kobe, I had a similar question to Brock's on the book Cliff you mentioned could probably take more hunting pressure, but you're not recommending it based on drought due to doe mortality. But if you removed more bucks, doesn't that help alleviate some of that pressure on the does? So why aren't you making a recommendation for an increase on the book cliffs as well?
We made a healthy recommendation for an increase on the book cliffs last year too, Josh, and that's part of it. But I mean, I get what you're saying biologically. It's a hard line to walk is it really their reduced carrying capacity, or was last year just really, really bad, if that makes sense?
Mike? I got another question for you, Kobe. The Thousand Lakes unit, 300 yeah. tags, how many lifetime licensees are choosing that now?
I don't have that with me.
It was like between 80 and 100 is what it's been historically. Like.
Yeah, it's a lot proportionally.
So those people are essentially having a limited entry hunting experience every year, because our limited entry units are managed 25 to 35, and that buck to doe ratio has hovered in the mid to upper 20s. Is that correct?
Mike, I think what you're saying is accurate. I don't know if all those bucks are coming off that unit or if some of them come off the fish lake, though.
Yeah.
That's the only part that I don't. But yeah, what you're saying is accurate. The unit's probably too small to be managed by itself or managed the way that it is. It's another one of those that probably we need to look at, and we're rewriting the statewide mule deer plan right now.
That was kind of my point for the question.
Okay. Ben, go ahead.
Kobe, follow-up question on the Thousand Lakes. You're recommending no change, and I noticed that it has the early rifle season now. Did it have the early rifle season last year?
It did last year as well.
Was there an increase last year in permits?
I don't remember that. Kent, do you?
I don't think so.
I don't think we've recommended an increase on that unit.
So we've added that season, but we haven't increased permits. With the addition of that season, would it be reasonable to maybe increase some permits since there's an additional season to help spread hunters out there?
That additional season would remove, we set the early season at 20% of the permits.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of going 20 to archery, 20 to muzzleloader, 60 to rifle, we did go 20 to archery, 20 to muzzleloader, 20 to early rifle, and 40 to late rifle. So there's some logic there, Ben.
Okay. Any other questions? I have one question, Cody. Please go to the slide with the Wasatch elk.
Yes.
One, I get asked about the Wasatch a lot. So,
sure.
So I've got to ask you, we're trending down, and we have a fairly steep increase. What is the reason for that?
Between 6.4 and 6.3 is so hard to see whether that's really a trend or a blip.
Uh-huh.
And I think just that it's sustaining the harvest. This last year, when I talked to hunters that hunted the Wasatch, it was interesting to hear that the quality was the highest they'd seen in years. I'm personally aware of 300-400-inch bulls that were taken off the Wasatch. Now, I've heard it. I hear it both sides on the Wasatch. One side is, what are we doing? We're hunting this unit so hard. And the other side is, we've got one awesome success story in the state, and that is the Wasatch. I don't know where all the bulls are coming from, but they seem to just keep coming. So the information we've shown is there's probably a net immigration from the tribe.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Kobe. Yep. All right. I'll turn it over to the audience for any questions. Any questions?
Jeremy Anderson, Mule Deer Foundation. Covey, question on the southern deer. Can you go to that slide?
Sure. General season, yeah.
Yes, please.
This one or the one before it?
Well, I think we could probably this one. Yeah, this one right here.
Okay.
Obviously, I'm a heck of a lot more educated now in the last couple meetings we've been to. And the data we have with these collars is insane. And what I'm wondering is what it's going to take. What's the trigger to say, hey, we need collars on the plateau, Boulder, Kaparowitz, because look at that trend right there. I think we have it on the Monroe, and we know why they're not living and what's going on there. Because if that's a funding thing, if that's a, you know, certainly that's something where we'd love to jump in.
Yeah. And I think there are plans to put some out there. I think talking to Daniel, the Migration Initiative, we've got plans to put some out there this year. So it just keep doing what you're doing. And I think we'll put some out there this year and start to see that. Let's see what's going on.
Okay. With the decreases in, you know, we've got the yellows.
Yeah.
We've dropped 100 tags, 300 tags, and looks like 600 tags on the Panguitch Lake. Is that sufficient? Is that...
You know, it really is. And if it's not, we pull back and readjust next year. But we're not going to do anything that's detrimental to that population with this recommendation.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Moving into the comment period. I don't have any cards. Did anybody want to make a comment on this? Just a reminder, the yellow cards are over there. If you want to make a comment, please fill one out. And thank you, sir. All right. Jeremy Anderson, go ahead.
So basically, I was getting with my questions, was going to end up being a comment. I guess my comment is, if we have these trending areas with mule deer, and we're all for opportunity, and like Kobe says, are we managing for this 30-inch buck that Brock kills, or the buck Kobe and I shoot? That's obviously a thing we've got to look at, but we have this data, and we know that in the southeastern Manti Kobe that these deer are dying mostly of lion kill, right? So let's attack that. You know, if whatever, you know, if we can collar these deer in the Boulder or in Panguitch Lake, if we're not collared there, let's find out why and let's attack it. That's my comment. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Jeremy. Troy, you're up.
Troy Justinson, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. I apologize for being late 2 hours to get down here. Holy cow. A lot of traffic.
Feel your weather. Pain.
Yeah. So, a couple things. We support the division's recommendations with a couple exceptions. One of which, I guess I asked Kobe, when you go through the once in a lifetime big game, is there any reason why you don't break it out unit by unit, that it's all just lumped? Because it would be extremely helpful to have that broken out like we do on some of those others.
I think part of it is just length of the presentation, Troy, and that's why we try to try to put it in the rack packet, but not break it out. It's something we could entertain, but it's, I know you guys like hear me talk, but how much do you...
We'll volunteer to bring Snickers for everybody, so if they get hangry, they can go have and have some of them. But, you know, our two areas of concern pertaining to the sheep production out there, the first of which is that of the Zion unit. And those of you who look through your rack packet, you should have received a letter to, or an email today from, you know, Travis Jensen, Wild Sheep Foundation. You know, here for the last 3 years, you hear us come by and push this archery only for bighorns. And one of the selling points was that it would not affect, you know, the rifle hunters or the, any weapon hunters. It did. Obviously, they cut, the recommendation is too shy. We're not in favor of that. If there's a unit that would support an increase in ram harvest, it is the Zion. Now, you're going to hear some say that the quality slipped. You know what? That's kind of okay for the simple fact. We have a factor there that not a lot of these other sheep units have, and that being Zion's National Park, which we have no control over. And they have a ton of sheep in there. And one thing that, you know, speeds up the crash of sheep units is as your population gets too high, and boom, all of a sudden we have nothing. And so we would ask the RAC that the division would add back those two permits and support the archery as well, and that's supported by Sports and Fish and Wildlife and the Wild Sheep. The other which is right here on the Wasatch. Last year we come and spoke to it too. Our concern is where the Wasatch, the Nebo, and the Venequin are all together, that, you know, the hunter draws those permits, and I think the recommendation is, what, 4 or 5 this year? 4. That all those could end up right here on the face, and we have the potential to over-harvest a unit. We actually believe it would be better managing these units on an individual basis, and quite frankly, I think we could jump up to 6 tags. But, you know, sitting on the statewide sheep committee for the sheep plan, one of our main focus was in changing the way we allocate permits was to be able to create subunits and target where we want the harvest. We believe the Wasatch is one of those, that we can break these units up and say we have 2 on the Wasatch, we have 2 on the Nebo, we have the American Fork and 2 on the Nebo type deal. But make those hunters harvest those sheep where they're at. And we'd also recommend that Venequin be closed. Very few sheep, most of those have died off. I think it'd be time to, you know, close that unit. So that's the changes. Otherwise, we support the division's recommendations. Thank you.
Thanks, Troy. Okay, I don't have any other cards. Any other comments? Feels like we're getting off easy tonight, guys. Okay, bring it back to the rack for discussion. Motions? Go ahead, Brock.
I'd like to hear either Riley or Kobe talk about what Troy just said, and maybe even Kobe or, and Teresa talk about the Zion, what he just said, to hear what their views are on the sheep.
Yeah, it's a unit-specific question. Let's let Riley and Teresa, since she's here, address that. If you want me to do it, I'll do it.
Quite honestly, I think we could break the Venequin off the unit very simply. We did add that together in years past in hopes of allowing more space and allowing for the opportunity to increase tags and increase opportunity. And I think that, quite honestly, if we would have thought about it in a different way this year, we might have separated it out, as we've talked about it in the past. So I think what Troy says is probably a pretty reasonable conversation. We do believe that the permit recommendation, as the way it stands right now, is the right recommendation. We feel like we have the sheep to harvest there. We feel like it is sustainable for years to come that way. But as far as breaking it out and putting the subunits, that's kind of, I mean, that's something that we could do next fall and even look at. It's a reasonable conversation. It's not something we were opposed to, but it's not something that was brought up this year.
Thank you. What about the Zion, Kobe?
The Zion's a little tougher. I want to let everybody know that I've had extensive conversations with the biologist, with Jason, who made this recommendation. And his intent was never to cut any weapon permits to add the archery hunt.
That's what's happened, right?
So he feels like so on paper, yes, you can see that there's an archery hunt added with 3 permits, and then 2 any weapon permits were cut. Jason would have cut any weapon permits regardless of the archery hunt this year. and the flight came in with fewer Class 3, Class 4 Rams, and he's within the recommendation to, or within the guidelines of the plan to do that. Also within the guidelines of the plan is to have those permits back in there with the archery permits. So there's enough flexibility there that it could go either way. When we've talked about the Zion, there was some intent or a thought process there to manage it for a bit more quality. One of the units we managed in Desert Bighorn Sheep for more trophy quality. And that's the rationale behind the recommendation. That's what I can give you.
All right. Thanks, Kelby. Any other comments?
I've got a question. So along those same lines, I keep hearing that we don't want to take away from the any weapon hunt, right? That was like all these archery tags are just like falling out of the sky like the rain. Like they're not impacting anything.
They're just magic.
So, yeah, they're just magic. They're just appearing. So what is the anticipated success rate for the archery hunt that you base these permits off of?
We had to start with a number, with something, Mike, yep, because we haven't ever done this before. Colorado has some of these hunts. They're pretty low. But different sheep and different populations act differently. You know, this one in the Uintas, they stand off the side of the road.
Yeah.
You know, on the Zion, and the timing, we assume it's going to be a bit tougher. We estimated 50%. But I don't know what it'll be. But that's what we estimated.
So you estimated 50%. So on the Newfoundland Mountains, where we have 4 tags, you're okay that we kill 2 sheep, right?
With the possibility of that.
With the possibility of killing 2 rams.
Sure.
So what would your recommendation been for the Newfoundland Mountains if we didn't have an archery hunt on that?
That's a hard question. I don't know if the biologist would have recommended any more, any weapon. He's right at the top of what he could recommend. And that is an area where we have seen a decrease in quality. So I
don't understand because
what you're saying.
You're going to kill 2 rams. That's what you anticipate.
So at 100% success, there's a possibility of adding 2 more any weapon permits.
That's kind of what I'm getting at. And I'll be supportive of the archery hunt, but I don't want to hear the talk that this doesn't take away from other people. I mean, these tags are so special. Yeah. And when we start separating them out and we start to say, well, we're not taking away from one and the other, I think it makes it really hard to for people that aren't putting in for archery tags to swallow that.
No, I understand that.
And Mike, for whatever it's worth, I think that the discussion around that is the idea that it might help point creep.
I understand the reasoning, but if you the way you help point creep, because you're only helping one segment of the applications,
but the idea
in their point creep,
part of that segment would go with those applications, or that tag segment as well.
Yeah, part of them will,
yeah.
But overall, you're going to increase the other side of it, so which we'll see in a little bit.
Ben, go ahead.
Kobe, I'm going to call you back up to the mic. Refresh my memory. During the writing of the sheep plan last year, didn't we have a survey about this exact topic, about filling out the public's willingness to... utilize archery as a tool for once in a lifetime permits.
The public overall was supportive. They're supportive of anything that could possibly offer more opportunity in bighorn sheep.
Yeah.
And Mike makes a good point. Like it's a hard line to walk. We are trying a lot of different avenues to. A lot of hunters want the chance at hunting a bighorn sheep.
Yeah, and I was a member on that sheep committee, and there were multiple themes that ran strong throughout every meeting of that committee. One of them was, we got to figure out how to issue more tags. Hunters want an opportunity to hunt, and that was a very heavy, strong theme, as I recall.
Okay, any other comments? Do we have a motion?
I have one more comment back to the Zion and the,
okay, go ahead, Brock.
And the Pine Valley, and that is, I spent a couple hours doing math today to try to figure out
how many deer are on these units and how many bucks are on these units and how many bucks we could harvest. Looking at the survival data, both of those units have 95% adult survival this winter, and they both have 65% fawn survival. And I calculated the total number of bucks on each of them. And it turns out that the Zion could take another 1,300 tags and still be an objective. And the Pine Valley could take another 550 to 600 tags and still be an objective. So, I mean, I make a motion that we push back a little bit and we take advantage of this opportunity and change those from a 300 and a 200 tag increase to like a 500 tag increase on each unit, which is still really conservative.
So to be clear, Brock, you're making a motion to increase general deer tags on Pine Valley. And what was the other unit?
And Zion.
Zion by 500 tags from 2018.
That's correct.
Okay.
The recommendation from the state is 300 and 200, I believe.
Okay.
Like, just so I'm aware, like, you know how to count deer.
Both of these units are 4,000 animals over objective.
Wow.
Bro, could you tell us what your credentials are, please?
Okay.
Well, just to be clear, 500 more than 2018.
Correct.
In addition to what...
Right. I want to be conservative. I don't want to crash these two buck-to-doe ratios, but I'm going to, when we get to antlerless, I'm going to recommend that we increase the number of antlerless animals taken off these to move it back toward... They're asking for 80 tags on the Zion, and it's 4,000 animals over objective.
Okay, so to be clear, we've got a motion on the board to increase the Pine Valley and Zion general deer units by 500 tags from 2018. Second? Okay, second from Ben. Any other discussion on that before we vote? Nope. Okay, let's take a vote. All in favor of that? 6. All opposed? Did everybody vote?
I abstained.
Oh. 1 abstention. Okay. Yes. So that motion passes 6-5.
Do we get those in the polls, raise your hand for a quick reason?
Do we see your sig?
One, two. Okay.
That's 4 and 1 abstention.
There should be 12, though.
11 voting members tonight.
Can't tell.
Well, because we did.
Oh, you can agree. Okay. Okay, so 6-4. 1 abstention. Okay, moving on. Do we have any other amendments to the recommendations, Ben?
I don't want to go as drastic as that, but part of me kind of wants to discuss the Thousand Lakes. We've got a new, well, as of last year, a new early any weapon hunt, but we didn't increase tags. We spread some hunters out, which is good, I suppose. I'd like to see more tags there. I'll make that motion that on the Thousand Lakes we increase tags. I'm not sure what number I want to go with. I'm open to suggestions. Mike, you look like you've got a comment.
Well, yeah, I mean, even 10 or 20%, that's 30 to 60 tags. I think that would be
Kobe, reasonable. What's your thoughts on that?
Teresa's glad she came.
I understand the rationale. It's outside of the management parameters and manage the plan. So,
does the division have a recommendation on what
can we see
a potential increase might be?
Right there. I think percentage wise, you know, not to jump too drastically, but a percentage is the best way to do an increase. So.
Okay, Kobe doesn't want to give us a number, Mike.
I'll
so
throw up 15%.
13%?
15.
Oh, 45 15. Tags?
Is that?
45 tags.
What that comes to.
Okay, so...
And those would be spread across archery, muzzleloader, early rifle, late rifle, yeah. Regular rifle.
Regular splits, yep.
Yeah, so that's just like handful of tags each
okay.
one.
Okay, so Ben, to be clear, the motion is to increase the Thousand Lakes general season deer unit by 15%, increase tags by 15% from 2018.
Correct.
I'll second that.
Okay. You get on that. Okay, so we got a motion by Ben, seconded by Mike. Any other discussion on that before we vote? Go ahead, Dan. Well,
only one comment. You know, the difference between some of these areas is that some of these areas can support a lot more camping and hunters, and I think Thousand Lake can support that kind of 15% increase. Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's important.
All right. Let's take a vote. All in favor of that? All opposed. Okay. Motion passes. We have another abstention on that? Okay. Okay, moving on. Any other amendments?
I'll keep going. Nobody else does.
Okay, go ahead, Ben.
Josh had something.
Kobe, I wondered if you could pull up the Zion sheet.
I don't have it here. It's in the rack. I mean, I don't have it right here. It's in the rack packet, but we can go through. It's not on the presentation, I guess, broken out is what I'm saying. It's a reduction in two permits, one from the early hunt and one from the late hunt. And then the addition of three archery permits.
Right.
It's an overall increase of one permit, but reductions in any weapons.
And that reduction was based on the idea of keeping it sort of a trophy quality hunt and then a flight that showed less. But the sentiment from the committee in the public was to increase that, and they sort of have this home base in Zion. So I guess I would make a motion to see that either maintain last year's level without the reduction.
Okay. All right. So that's...
Is that the any weapon without the reduction? Is that what you're saying?
Or any weapon and keep the archery as well.
Okay, so let's clarify that motion, Josh.
So I think to simplify the motion, the motion is essentially increase by two over the DWR's recommendation on the rifle arm.
Yeah, that would be correct.
Okay,
I'll second that.
Okay.
Kobe, you did say that would fall within the guidelines of the plan on that unit, correct?
It does fall within the guidelines.
Okay. Yeah, and just further comment on that, going back again to the sheep committee and the, you know, we changed some of the management plans to be able to increase permits and to provide more opportunity. And again, that's what our constituents are looking for. So that's why I support that.
One quick. So are you recommending an increase in what about the non-resident permits? I think that's important. Money.
So would that increase by two change anything?
They're always
there?
Just percentage based.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, probably wouldn't impact non-residents. So it'll be.
Yeah, what you could say is the same number of any weapon permits as last year with the additional archery permits, if that was a motion that you wanted to make.
Okay. Okay, so. To be clear, the motion is to maintain the 2018 Zion Bighorn sheep permits in 2018.
Yep.
Okay. Okay, and that was seconded?
With the addition of the archery permits.
Right.
With the addition of the archery permits, okay. Okay. So that was the motion by Josh, seconded by, was it Ben? Okay. Okay, any other discussion before we vote on that? Okay, all in favor? Any opposed?
No. There's one absent. 10.
That passes. Okay, any other amendments? Ben, anything else?
Okay. The only other thing that I've got on my notes is the what Troy had mentioned about the sheep on the Wasatch. I don't know if I'd know enough about that situation to make a motion or to, I don't know. I'd love to entertain that discussion if others are willing. I don't know that I have enough the information at this point to do anything with it, though.
I think there's a couple management issues outside of the permit area that I'd like to maybe talk about after we pass this to give direction to the division. Or would you rather we do it before we pass the balance?
Does it have to do with any
not with permit numbers?
We'll tackle that after we come back to that, Mike. If that works. Okay, so Ben, you wanted to discuss.
Yeah, so maybe Kobe can help educate me here. Help me understand what the concern is, whether that's you or Troy, or explain it to me like I'm five.
I think that there are basically two schools of thought. One, we understand that the Aviniquin should have been split out this last fall. And Troy makes a good point on that we could probably offer more opportunity right now with the way the sheep populations are today. By breaking them up.
So how many units are we talking about here?
It could be broken up either into two or three.
What is it currently?
It's currently one unit. So it's the Wasatch, Nebo, and Aviniquin. And the reason why is because not very many years ago, we didn't have enough sheep to even have a hunt.
Okay, because they used to be separate units, and then we combined them into one unit for that reason, correct?
Yeah, we didn't have enough sheep to even hunt. And one of the concerns is always that, you know, again, there are two schools of thought. One is if we can direct pressure and harvest, we can probably manage these better. And that's accurate. The other school of thought is that sheep die sometimes. And if the units are smaller, you call a hunt, you draw hunters, and then you have to call those hunters and tell them to stay home. And so the other school of thought is if it's bigger and you lose the Rock Canyon herd or you lose the Temp herd, that a hunter could still hunt Nebo.
So the concern, Troy, I think then what I'm hearing is that all the tags kill the sheep out of the same herd in the same on the same mountain rather than across the unit.
Exactly. So Troy's concern is that there would be pointed pressure. Am I getting that right, Troy? Pointed pressure. And I would just echo that you can only harvest a sheep once. So after it's dead, it's dead.
It seems like a valid concern and a discussion worth having. It just feels to me a little late in the game for this year.
Even with the way it's set up, the recommendation of four is appropriate. The unit can handle it, and it can handle it this year. You know, one thing I'm not bringing up is this last year we reduced by a permit, and this last spring I'm aware of three deadheads that have come off the face. You know, we picked up a 182-inch ram, and now we're going to give that to somebody instead of giving somebody a permit. We picked up another dead 7-year-old on the Aviniquin, and we have now another dead ram instead of a permit. So I think we're willing to have the discussion next fall about this and break these up and do it a little differently. We're open to that, but I'm comfortable with the recommendation.
Thanks, Kelvin. Mike?
So I'm a little bit concerned about, Chris asked me to do this now, but I'm a little bit concerned about some of these elk units, and their objective is so high it's unattainable, such as the Nebo, which in 11 years has been over 1.5 years below its objective, or over a year below its objective. So, and we've cut tags on that unit, for example, from 160 tags down to like 48 now is what we're going to go for. It's the Wasatch and the Manti both have 5.5-year-old objectives. The Nebo has a 6.5, and it's sponge. Those bulls are sponging off there. And Kevin's probably shaking his head because they did the same thing on the Monroe for years in that kind of, you know, unit. And so And then I look at the West Desert Deep Creeks. I mean, that age objective is so high, and we're at the lowest threshold we can be with. So I would, the way to address this would be to offer some kind of a motion to direct, to ask the Wildlife Board to direct the division to reopen the elk committee. Is that what you said? Yeah. Okay. So I'd make the motion that we ask the Wildlife Board to look into to reconvene the elk committee to address chronically low age objective units.
Okay, so we got a motion to ask Wildlife Board to open the elk plan specifically for the purpose of looking at units with chronically low
average age
against the objective.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Do I have a second for that? Josh will second. Okay. Any discussion before we vote on that? Go ahead, Ben.
A couple questions. Mike, you stated, you pointed out the Nebo specifically. Are there other units you're concerned with as well, or is it just the Nebo?
Well, there's the Deep Creeks. You know, and just notice that he's recommending 20 permits, but it's, you know, because he needs to kill some elk.
Sure.
But it's almost, what, 2 years, a year and a half below the, and it's been chronically down there.
Didn't we raise the objective on the Deep Creeks in the last plan?
Yeah, and the Deep Creeks is probably a little bit different, but because we're trying to be good partners with the tribe, mm-hmm. and manage for an older age class bull. But it's a valid point in that if it won't sustain the harvest of 20 bulls and meet the age objective, does it really fit that?
Yeah.
And then my other question for Covey, what, I mean, this isn't a topic really for the elk management plan, right? The elk committee, elk management plan. One, and refresh my memory, do you know when is the plan up for?
It's a 7-year plan. It was written
we're about halfway there.
2022, 2023. So we've got a ways. Sometimes it is appropriate to open a plan and look at things midway if we're not meeting certain objectives.
So I have one other question before you sit down, Kobe. What's happened to the elk population on the Nebo when we've gone from 140 tags to 40 tags? Is it 30% the size, or is it still the same population and we're just squandering a resource?
It's been over objective for several years, and then it came back down under this last year. Brock, that's a hard question. I haven't seen drastic changes in the population. We're again back under what were the objective, but probably not offering as much opportunity as we could.
And I think you mentioned earlier that the Nebo would be a prime unit to look at.
It would be. Yep.
For that reason. Okay. Any other discussion before we vote on this? Is everybody clear on the motion? Okay. All right. All in favor?
I'll vote yes.
I
changed my mind.
Okay. Nine in favor. Anybody on this side was a yes, I believe.
I was not.
Oh, Ben was not. Okay. Sorry, you're all getting one clump from here. Okay, you good on that? Okay, all opposed. And Ben and Ken.
And just to clarify, I'm not opposed to addressing the age objective. I just don't know if it's worth reconvening the elk committee for the discussion of just the Nebo. I think that could be
managed
as is and punted until the next committee. That's my only opposition.
Well, the motion, unless you have something different, Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, was to ask the Wildlife Board to open the elk plan to address that.
And maybe not reconvene. It's to open the elk plan, right?
That's what I had as an option.
To open the elk plan. And that way they can look at, you know, the Deep Creeks and just assess a few of those, and maybe they'll come back and they'll say, no, they're good, and we'll just go on our merry way. But.
Well, and also, 7 years, that's a pretty long time. You know, that's hard to react to. 5 years, that's a little better. And so that's why I support it. Okay. All right. Any other amendments, or do I have a motion to approve the balance? Anyone?
I'll move to approve the remainder.
All right. Thank you, Brock. Do you have a second? Christine?
Yes. Amy.
Okay. Any other discussion before we vote on that? Okay, great. All in favor? I pass unanimously. Okay. Moving on. Looks like we get to hear from you again, Kobe.
Lucky. Okay, on to the 2019 antlerless permit recommendations. When biologists recommend antlerless permits, here are some of the things that they consider. One is managing depopulation objectives. So state code does require that we make and manage depopulation objectives. Another one is we assess herd health annually and look at body condition scores of these animals, especially deer. And also cause specific mortality. So if we just have too many animals on the landscape. Another one is that we might have healthy deer, but we've seen range health decrease significantly. So we have our range trend study, and then our biologists do spring range assessments every year to see how our spring range looks. And finally, the impact on private property. So depredation or growing populations in areas where we don't want to grow populations that have minimal public benefit but have a lot of impact on some of our producers in the state. So with that, we'll jump into deer recommendations. As you saw earlier, our fawn production in 2018, we dipped with fawn doe ratios being at about 50, 53, 54. Fawns per 100 does, I guess I should say. But with the dip in fawn doe ratios, we saw also an increase in fawn survival in 2018. So more of our fawns survived last year, even though there were fewer at the beginning. This is the statewide population estimate. It almost seems a little bit counterintuitive, understanding what happened last year with severe drought and the impacts that we saw in portions of southern Utah, a lot of southeastern Utah, and then even portions of northeastern Utah, including the Bookliffs. But with that, we also had portions of the state, some of our largest herds in the central portions of the state and some of the northern portions of the state, where we didn't lose as many deer. In fact, we grew deer. Overall, the model population this year is about 372,000 deer in the state. And with that, we're recommending an increase in antlerless permits from 1955 to 2720. So a healthy increase there from the 2018 number of permits to the 2019 recommendation. Looking at some of the new hunts and some of the decreases and increases, recommending an increase on the Chalk Creek from 250 to 300. And East Canyon, recommending an increase there. A lot of private land in East Canyon, and one of these hunts is a private land only hunt. And that's to help address some of the depredation issues there. In the southeastern region, on the 9 mile, recommending an increase. This is on and around Green River and Price areas. So more residential, and then the San Juan Abajo, recommending an increase there of 30 as well. In the southern region, recommending decreases on the Panguitch Lake and the Plateau Boulder, recommending a slight increase on the Southwest Desert and a decrease on the Zion. Overall, net increase, again, from 1955 to 2720 statewide. Under our elk recommendations, our statewide model population this year, we dipped. So the population objective, you'll see there on the left, is the population estimate. So 20 to 100,000 on the y-axis. On the x-axis is the year. The population objective is the sum of all the unit plans. And the sum of all the unit plans, our population objective for the state of Utah right now is 78,215 animals. And we're right there at 79,090. So we actually reduced elk in the state this last year. Just a reminder again, we hunt elk a little differently. And part of that is because elk are really smart. They're smart. They're susceptible to pressure. They change their behaviors. And so adding permits does not always increase elk harvest. And so there are a couple different methods we use. One, we do provide public opportunity and public drawing permits. Two, we use private lands only permits. And these are to redistribute elk and provide tools to private landowners to harvest offending animals when there are depredation issues and harvest the right animals. And three, antlerless elk control permits on units where it's beneficial. And antlerless elk control permits allows a hunter in the field that has a buck or a bull permit to harvest a cow elk, to buy a permit and harvest a cow elk while he's out harvesting that buck or bull. And we use this in situations where we don't necessarily want to add hunters to the field, but also need to help maintain the population objective. So with that, here's the breakdown of the permits. So last year we noticed, and we showed just that we were decreasing public draw permits again and again. And we thought we have to really add in and show what's really going on the landscape. Although we're decreasing public draw permits, we're increasing in private lands only permits to help redistribute these animals and help hunting help us be more successful at managing to our population objectives. So we're recommending for this year a total of 9,635 public draw permits and 9,785 private lands only permits. Under our public draw, on the left side is the unit, followed by the population objective, the estimate, the 2018 recommendation, and 2019 permits. So there on the box elder, we're right at about the population objective, recommending a decrease at 30 permits. On the cash, slightly above, and recommending an increase there. You have to remember in some of these units in northern Utah as well, these permits in the public draw and the private lands only, they don't represent all of the permits on the unit. A lot of these units are heavy in private lands. Chalk Creek, for example, is 98% private land. And so a lot of that harvest has to occur on that private land, and there's large CWMUs that help with that harvest. It's also one of the only areas in the state, it's weird, when the private landowners are the ones asking for more elk in this area of the state. They're the ones saying, well, we can grow a few more elk. And it's the division saying, no, we need to manage to the population objective. So, we can handle a few more. And part of that is the dynamic that's created with CWMUs. With that, again, on the CAMAS, population estimates there is under, recommending a decrease. On the North Slope Summit, we're under there and recommending a decrease. And on the Ogden, under and recommending a decrease. Overall decrease of permits. In the northeastern region, starting with the Book Cliffs, under the population objective there and recommending a decrease in permits. On 9 Mile Anthro, where we're above, recommending an increase. North Slope under and recommending a decrease. South Slope Diamond Mountain Vernal, recommending an increase in public draw permits. South Slope Yellowstone is another one of these really tricky ones. There's a lot of tribal land in that area. We use antlerless elk control permits there, as well as private lands only. And so what you're seeing doesn't represent what's going on the landscape there, but recommending a decrease there as well. Wasatch Mountains of Inequin, recommending permits there where we didn't last year. Overall in the northeastern region, recommending a decrease in permits. But out of the central region, with the Nebo being below objective, recommending a decrease there. And West Desert, this portion, this increase is in a portion of the unit where we're trying not to grow elk. So on the Tinnick and Vernon areas. But the West Desert unit includes all the way out to the Deep Creeks. Central Mountains Manti, under the population objective there, and recommending a decrease. On the Henry Mountains, recommending to not have a public draw hunt there this year. Very few elk there. Hard to find the elk. It is in antlerless control, and so if someone has a buck or a bull permit, they can harvest the elk while they're on the unit. On the LaSalle's, slightly above, and recommending an increase. 9 Mile Range Creek, we're below there and recommending no permits. The San Juan, recommending a slight decrease there and recommending to maintain on the Santa Fe for an overall decrease on the southeastern region as well. On to the southern region. We're above the population objective on the Beaver and recommending an increase in permits there. On the Fillmore, slightly below, recommending a decrease. On the Monroe, Mount Dutton, Panguitch Lake, below and recommending decreases on those. On the Paunsagant, where we're above the objective, recommending to increase that. And the Pine Valley, recommending a slight increase there as well. The Plateau Boulder, we're at the bottom end of that objective and recommending a decrease there. And the Plateau Fish Lake Thousand Lakes, we're below the population objective and recommending a decrease there. Southwest Desert, this is a unit where we have been super aggressive. And so when that flight came in, I think everybody was a little surprised, but the biologist is being very aggressive there and recommending a healthy increase. And then on the Zion, recommending a very slight increase there. So new elk hunts, and these are, the maps are at the back of the rack packet. But just a reminder, a new hunt on the Beaver East, two new hunts in the Box Elder Pilot Mountain, two new hunts in Cache Richmond Hyde Park, a new hunt on the Nebo there, the Central Mountains Moroni Hills, and the Central Mountains Nebo proper, a new hunt on the Fillmore Oak Creek, the limited entry portion, a new hunt on the LaSalle Mountains Taylor Flat, a new hunt on the 9 Mile of Inequin West Anthro, three new hunts on the Southwest Desert, as well as three new hunts on the Southwest Desert Northwest part to fit those additional permits in there. And recommending a new hunt on the Wasatch Mountains of Inequin and the West Desert Pindic as well. Just a recap of the antlerless elk over-the-counter permits. So there are two types of these. I explained this before, but the first one is antlerless elk control permits. And that allows a hunter to harvest a cow while he's in the field hunting bucks or bulls. And the other is the private lands only permits. And these permits are valid on private property from August 1st to January 31st. And they go on sale July 23rd. So both over the counter. A recap of the antlers elk only permits. Last year they were available on 10 units. And 34 hunters chose to purchase those. Of those, about 15% harvest success, or 500 elk, were harvested. And this year, we're recommending it on the following 8 units: the Chalk Creek, Henry Mountains, Pine Valley, West Desert Vernon, East Canyon, Morgan South Ridge, South Slope Yellowstone, and West Desert Tinnick. Under the private lands only permits, this one is interesting. So we sold about the same number of permits last year, and we harvested half as many elk. So if you remember last year when we had a light winter, we had less conflict with elk in depredation situations. And this just highlights that these permits work to help resolve some of those. So this year we had a harder winter, more conflict, and doubled the success rate from 22% to almost 44%. And private landowners were helped were able to solve their own problems or use public hunters to solve some of the depredation issues. They've been still well received by landowners. They simplified the process in obtaining permits. And it helps also redistribute elk on the landscape. We saw this with the Wasatch study. You know, when we hit the heart of the deer hunt, when we had the most hunters on the mountain, 75% of the elk were on private land that first year before we implemented private lands only. And then as we've implemented these types of hunt strategies, we've seen that those elk redistribute to where we don't have that sharp peak where they're all on private land from the pressure. This is what the private lands only recommendations look like by unit. So adding a couple new units, Fox Elder East and Beaver East, increasing on the Manti, decreasing on the Nebo a bit while we're under the objective, a new hunt on the Fillmore Oak Creek, and increasing on the LaSalle's. Private lands only continued, decreasing on the North Slope, increasing on the Ogden, a new hunt there on the Santa Fe, and recommending an increase on the South Slope Bonanza Vernal. And one more. That new hunt there, that West Desert Tunic Valley, recommending. That didn't cover both. It was a hunt last year, but it only covered the Vernon. This year it covers the Vernon and the Tunic units, as well as an increase there on the Zion. The Doe Pronghorn recommendations. Last year we issued 645 permits and recommending an increase in that to 760 permits this year. A new hunt on the Beaver, where we've had a population spring up there. Recommending decreases on the Box Elder, Cache Morgan Southridge, and Mount Dutton Ponsagon. Also a new hunt on the Central Mountains, Manti. And a new hunt, or recommending an increase on the Fillmore and on the North Slope. Pronghorn permits continued. A new hunt on the Panguitch Lake, recommending an increase on the Parker Mountain, a decrease on the Santa Fe North, a new hunt on the South Slope, and that's your increase from 645 to 760. On the moose, cow moose recommendations, recommending a very slight increase of 4 permits, increasing 2 on the Ogden and 2 on the Ogden West. And that's all.
Thank you, Covey. Covey, I got a question for you. I don't know why you're sitting down getting comfortable. I know it's not a big problem to solve, but I'm just curious. You've got a couple of units in the state, particularly the Henrys, where we really don't want elk there at all, right? Have you ever thought about just sending everybody that draws a buck tag, a cow elk tag?
An interesting strategy. We've thought of a lot of things on the Henrys. Do we know what percentage of the hunters that draw a buck tag down there buy one of these antlerless control permits? Somebody text Lindy. We can find out how many buy them. You're right. I mean, we don't want elk there. It's an interesting strategy of walking that line of balancing the resource and the resource has value. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to give it away, and that's why we offer it for sale. But maybe we could do a better job at communicating, hey, if you have a permit on the Henrys, here's your chance to buy an antlerless elk permit and they are at a reduced rate.
Right, yeah, something.
Yeah, I think they're control permits are $35. So it's like $15 below what a cheaper than a tank of gas. But we could market it better, I think, Chris.
Sure. Sure. Okay. Questions, Dan?
Yeah, Kobe. So the one that struck me in the face, especially after asking that you know, bringing up that issue of, you know, snow mortality, the East Canyon going to 1,000. I mean, that was like, that was a huge leap. And that's where I hunt. And it just seems to me that the East Canyon area with private property interests, right? It tends to be a boom and bust thing, you know? And so what are we going to do? We're going to increase the permits big time. And then you said a year out, we'll have to decrease them because the critters might be all dead in the bottom of draws.
Yeah. And I understand that. I think to be fair, 500 of those permits, the biologists really wanted to distribute pressure. And so 500 of those permits are for private lands only.
Oh.
You can only hunt private land. And so he understood that when he got looking into it and said, you know, if you want to harvest a doe on your private land, here's a chance to do it without going through the depredation program. Put in, draw a permit, you got access, go hunt.
Yeah, but you go knock on David Bernoffel's door.
No. And I would say, and this is one of the things we stress, get permission before you put in for the permit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Brock?
Once again, Kobe.
I want to see your credentials.
I'm trying to understand why we decreased doe tags on the Zion. It cut it in half, even though they've grown 5,000 deer on the unit and they're 4,000 over objective, and we're cutting doe tags. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, Brock. The reason that I can give is that a lot of the doe hunts are probably more to target specific depredation or urban issues and less to manage to the population objective. And right or wrong, doe harvest in Utah for a long time has been socially, it's a hard pill to swallow, but I think we're moving that direction, Brock. I think we're getting better.
I was going to say, we sent an email to Lindy and she said that the demand for the doe tags is greater than the demand for the buck tags. Is that true?
That is accurate. It is. There is a demand for these permits, and healthy, active wildlife management means that you harvest does. We're working really hard right now, and I think that in this new statewide plan, we'll probably get more tools to address this and managing deer a little more proactively.
Okay, any other questions?
So on that unit, did you say it was the Zion?
Both the Zion and the Pine Valley are 4,000 over objective.
Okay. Is it fair to reason, based on that maybe those objectives need to be adjusted?
So that's the alternative, for sure.
That's the alternative, yeah.
I mean, if they're that far over objective and we're not recommending an increase in tags, I assume that the range conditions are reasonably decent, that we don't have carrying capacity issues. I'm just trying to fill out the situation and yeah.
Ben, what I would say is that I think those plans were rewritten 2 years ago, Teresa, two or three. More or less. They come up every 5 years. And we saw a significant spike in those populations, and probably the reason they weren't adjusted is because they wanted to wait and see if that was a spike and then they'd go back down, or if really habitats change or conditions have changed to where that's the new normal. Okay. And if that's the new normal, I'm certain that we would address it in the next plan.
Any other questions? Ken?
Yeah. Well, didn't they just do a capture and study collaring issue on the Zion this last winter?
Caught on the Zion and 80? Caught 80 deer on the Zion this last year.
And you tag and you collared those?
Okay, any other questions? All right. Turn it over to the audience. Any questions from the audience? Come on up. State your name, please.
Val Anderson. Kobe, The very first slide with deer, the statewide objective in terms of population.
The model population objective, Al?
Yeah. It looked like for a long time, we right there, let's see, that's elk. I need the...
We're close. Okay.
The population objective is 453,000.
Yeah.
We haven't reached that in, what, 2-3 decades?
Probably mid-80s.
So why should we have any depredation doe tags if we can't ever get to our population objective? Is that a bad number? Is it as unit by unit where we've got some that are just like we just mentioned the Zions that they're doing really good and others just doing really bad? But why can't, under active management, why can't we reach population objectives or even come close to it?
Yeah, Val, that's a really good question. So population objectives, the way they're set, they're a sum of the unit objectives, right? So we don't set those in the statewide plans. It's more detail. We dive in deeper, look at habitat, look at other conditions, and say, how many deer could we have here? And really, the data that we're getting now over the last 5 years is starting to help us answer that, because we've asked those same questions. Why don't we have possibly the number of deer we had here before? And by the data we're getting now, I mean, some of these collaring studies, we're getting really heavy into cause-specific mortality of does and cause-specific mortality of fawns as well. And so we're able to start addressing why these populations aren't growing, and then ask the question, do we have the right number? Do we need to look at this again? Do we need to readjust? Are we out of carrying capacity? But the truth is, we haven't been able to manage at that level until probably the last couple of years. We just didn't have the data. Now that we have it, as we go through rewriting unit management plans, and every year we rewrite a region's unit management plan. So this year we're on region... What's that? Southern region. Oh, Teresa, you're up. So this year, she'll rewrite her unit management plans, and at that point, they would probably look at that and possibly adjust upwards some of those population objectives, which again adds to this overall sum and makes it higher. Whereas there are other units where it's probably too high, Val, and we need to really take a look at it and see, is this possible? Our constituents associate that with a lot of loss. You know, when we tell them, you know, the population objective on the Manti is 38,000. We've had 23,000 deer there for 24,000 deer there for several years. Someone in that neighborhood, am I right, Kent? 25,000 deer there for several years. We're probably never going to hit 38,000 again in the foreseeable future unless something drastically changes. It's a really hard pill to swallow. And they say, no, we want to leave it. That's the goal. We want to hit that. But maybe some of them are really unrealistic, and we need to look at that harder.
You know, and I'd add to that, when the Mule Deer Committee got together last time, we had input on the population objective number. The idea was there was no way to sit down and calculate statewide what is the carrying capacity. So we wanted to hang a number on the board that was aggressive enough that we didn't feel like we could hit it the next year or two, because we wanted to keep working. We didn't want the plan to stop being aggressive for growing deer in Utah. So the way I recall it was we wanted it aggressive enough that we would continue to do habitat projects and continue to manage to grow deer in Utah. So that was part of the rationale behind that number.
Yeah, and along those lines, there was 280,000 deer when we met as that Mule Deer Committee. And then we set it in 2014, and we set a goal to have 350,000, because, you know, we as committee members could impact that. And then, boom, we got great weather, great conditions, great fawning. We surpassed that. But it seemed like that they never really reduced those population objectives. Unless if they're way below, it's
a lot of loss associated with reductions, yeah. and that's hard for the public.
Okay, any other questions from the audience?
Larry.
Larry Fitzgerald, I'm representing myself, and thank you guys for your service. I know how well it pays. But Kobe, you know, on this private lands tags and stuff, you need to educate people a little bit better. People don't understand these tags. I talk to people all the time about the tags, and they don't understand. They can buy the tag with the bull or the horn tag and the private lands tag and all this and that. But besides that, how many elk were harvested in the Burnham using these tags? Was it successful?
Antlerless control in private lands?
Yes.
It was successful. Kent, do you have those numbers? Or Rusty? Harvested 75 elk on the Vernon with antlerless control. So if somebody had a Vernon buck tag, they could have gone and bought one of these over the counter in 75, Rusty? 74. Okay, so we sold quite a few, and
it's a very good opportunity. Is there more opportunity? You could even increase it more, where you're including the Tinnick Valley, and does that include the Dog Valley?
Yeah. Rusty, do you want to speak specifically to that unit boundary?
I know there was some issues. You guys were trying to figure out your boundaries. Yeah. There was a lot of issues there. So let's throw Rusty under the bus.
Sorry, Larry. What was your question again?
Is there an opportunity to increase these tags more for more opportunity because you're including, and are these tags going to overlap with the Tinnick and West Desert Vernon? Do they overlap so you can hunt both sides of Highway 6?
So the antlerless control permits, there's no cap on those, correct? Anybody that has a buck or a bull tag can purchase that, yeah. And they're unit specific, so those hunting the Vernon can purchase an antlerless control permit.
About the private lands tag, you put a limit on those. Have they sold out?
We increased those this year, and we combined the Tintic with the Vernon. So now it's called the West Desert Tintic Valley, and it's the total West Desert Tintic boundary combined with the West Desert Vernon boundary, and I believe we did 150 permits on those.
Is that going to be, do you think that's enough tags in that area? You know, it's the reason I'm getting to this is because I know in down and around Nephi and that, the division has to go in and take elk, and that,
correct.
They're out of the public. The public doesn't have an opportunity to take those elk.
Right.
With these tags, the public has an opportunity to harvest an elk where they normally wouldn't.
Correct. So in addition to the private land only permits and the antlerless control permits, which the Tintic side has never had before, we also did a 75 permit draw hunt for cows for antlerless elk on the Tintic. In addition,
the Vernon
already had one, and that will continue.
Is that tag go from August to January, or is it a set?
I'm not sure about the Vernon, but the Tintic, yes, goes August 1st to January 31st. So from August 1st to January 31st, you can get a private land only permit, draw that permit, or if you have any buck or bull hunts anywhere in that time frame, you can purchase an over-the-counter antlerless control permit. So basically through everything, every tool we have at that Tintic unit.
And the division still use the same tools if these tags aren't so in cornfields, hay fields, if you guys have to go in and get them at night, because these are very smart animals, like everybody knows.
Yeah, we're still going to, is that what your question is, are we still going to take a hard look at those cornfields? Yes.
You can take them out of the hunting opportunity.
Yeah. And that's what we're trying to eliminate with this, Larry, is all the depredation problems. And there's an opportunity for hunters to take them, and we'd rather not. And we'd rather let hunters have
them. This is a zero objective area.
Technically, it's not.
Vernon is, though.
It's right. So I think the unit as a whole, the West Desert, I think it names 200 elk on the Deep Creeks. That aren't on the tribe land, and it also names 150 elk in Dog Valley, and Dog Valley, Sage Valley combined.
And there was a little bit of talk of even going north with these tags. Is that
It'll encompass that Cedar Valley area and
Cedar Valley.
All that, yep.
Okay, well, that's really good. So, you did good, Rusty.
Thanks.
I encourage, you know, let's let the public kill these elk instead of having the division go in and take them out. And so every opportunity they have, this is my comment, I should do this later on, but the pronghorn in Rush Valley and Cedar Valley. Is this our new biologist?
Yeah, and I would just say for unit-specific questions, these guys are here, and they love to answer questions, so they didn't dress up for nothing.
Hi, Jason. There's over the years, I know the history of the pronghorn. I was out there, I lived out there, and I was a livestock operator when they first put these pronghorn out there, and I know where they were supposed to stay and where they're not now and where they are now. I don't know if you are you doing any antlerless tags to Cedar Valley, Rush Valley, Cedar Valley, trying to keep them out of the urban areas. The old biologist, he kind of refused. He didn't think there was a problem there, but it's been a huge problem from what I understand.
So we're not recommending any permits this year for doe for pronghorn. We just completed the flight. So we're still in the process of analyzing that data, but we were able to do a full flight of that area to get us a better idea of where we are in relation to the population objective.
So you haven't got all the data back, so you don't know, but do you think it could stand a antlerless hunt in those areas?
There's maybe some areas near some of the ag fields that we can look at for sure.
I think some of the private landowners would encourage it. I hope the RAC would think about that in the future, you know, when you get your data back.
And I think one of the main reasons we haven't is we've been chronically under our population objective in that unit. But we'll be able to look at that here with this new data.
I know the population objective, but it's keeping the animals in the areas where they're supposed to be, not become urban animals to where they're out of the hunting population. Right now, so the antelope going into Camp Williams and over into Harriman, Bluffdale, and all, and even in the Eagle Mountain, they're out of the hunting population. I would hope Fish and Game and you guys would consider trying to keep them out of the city limits where they could be, people could hunt them. So that's all I got, guys. Appreciate your time.
Thanks. Do you have a yellow card you wanted to turn in for the comment period? All right. Any other questions from the audience?
Kobe, I'm gonna make you get up again.
Great.
Can you go to the mule deer doe San Juan area?
This one?
No. Yes. Sorry.
Yeah, those permits are on and around. So the boundary is actually the town of Monticello.
Okay, that's what I'm hoping it was. I mean, with the mortality we had there. So
yeah, okay. Yes, that's a good question.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, any other questions? All right, come to the comment period. I think Larry's scribbling out a card real fast. Anybody else? Troy.
I actually admire the Fish and Game for the DNR for the division for making these efforts and trying to control these elk in a zero population area. The Vernon unit, you know, we're trying to maintain a deer unit. I think they're trying. Years ago, guys like me and the division didn't get along too well, but nowadays we get along just because of they got, in my opinion, a better class of people in the division. So, I don't want to get other than Kobe. Rusty's a good dude. So. And he's welcome at my place anytime. But thank you for your time and thank you.
Thanks, Larry. Troy?
Troy Justinson, Sports Fish and Wildlife. My question, Kobe, did they pass these out at conference or what, the white shirts and all? I'm used to brown, man. So,
Troy, you need to address them as elder.
And yeah, elder, yeah, that's it. But my other question, again, Kobe, is it written still in code that if you get a doe tag, you have to give up your man card? being serious, Sports Fish and Wildlife supports the division's recommendations with the following exception, and that would be the beaver. We acknowledge that the elk numbers are going up, but it goes along the lines of what you talked about earlier. Sometimes more is less. And the local committee feels that with the number permits there, that, you know, the harvest is going down on antlerless, and that they could actually be more effective in harvesting those cows if there wasn't so many people. And it was also, you know, talked about getting with, you know, the local livestock, the local producers to target, you know, in the past they target specific areas where there's problem. They found that to be effective, and so we'd like to see that happen again. Just to address one thing you brought up, Brock, I mean, you're asking Kobe a lot of questions on how come, whatnot, but you really control these answers. I mean, we put up on the board that, hey, this is our objective. That's just a figure. Really, we need to manage based upon the health of the herd, and that lies in your realm.
I agree.
Because quite frankly, you know, that number, if it's too high and our deer are unhealthy, we need to adjust that. And so as we go into the Pine Valley and we go into the Zion, based upon the health of the herd, maybe, you know, if they are healthy, our does are healthy, our bucks are healthy, we can raise that objective. If they're not, we need to harvest those animals. So it's very exciting the work you're doing with BYU and the division. So hats off to you guys. I think the future is real bright. Thank you.
Thanks, Troy. Okay. I don't have any more cards. Any other comments? Great. Bring them back to the rack for discussion. Go ahead, Dan. Yeah, Cody. So this is trivial, I'm sure. Some antelope probably waded across from Antelope Island to the Salt Lake City.
You mean?
Northwest, yeah, swam or floated over to the Northwest Quadrant. And so it's a pretty good herd there. But now with the you know, the inland port and the prison issues, that herd is going to be history. It's not a big herd. It's like 50. I counted 55 animals the other day. But, you know, are you guys interested in moving those critters?
Slow down. Danny, do you mean the ones like by Harriman and Bluffdale area?
I mean the ones just west of downtown Salt Lake City, just west of the
north of I-80.
The most watchable antelope in the state, almost.
Oh, okay.
They're great, but are we going to try to move those things, or are we going to try to use antlerless permits, or what are we going to do with those critters?
I'm not familiar enough with that group to speak right now. We've tried to capture pronghorn in these residential areas a lot. It's tough. The best way to capture pronghorn is a funnel trap. Okay. At times we've got them coming to bait, but we've got to have the right conditions. And that area, I'm sure if it allowed for a hunt, we would probably offer that up.
Yeah, but it's inside Salt Lake City.
That's the problem. And I'm not saying that we wouldn't try to catch them, but pronghorn are really picky and hard to get under a drop net.
Yeah.
And flying a helicopter at low level flight in those areas is also unacceptable.
Hey, Covey, I got a quick question for you. So, on the Vernon specifically, particularly the private lands only tags, maybe that's a question for Rusty, but I'm just wondering, how many tags we sold last year? Did we sell them all?
We sold 40. I got this, 43, and we harvested. We harvested 43. Yeah, 3,703 harvested.
Didn't we raise that last year? That number?
Yeah. Yes, but well, we initiated that hunt last year. We didn't have it before.
Oh, that's right.
This year we. Last year we initiated it. This year we expanded the boundary and changed the boundary to cover both the Vernon and the Tinnick Valleys.
So we had 3,700 tags for sale. We sold 43.
We had how many tags for sale? I can pull it up right here. Okay. Last year we had 100 permits for sale. We sold 43. We had 3 harvest.
Okay. So it probably doesn't do us much good to look at.
We didn't hit the cap last year. And if we start hitting it and having higher success, obviously we would address that.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thanks, Cody. All right. Any other discussions? Do we have a motion? Or Ben?
Yeah, move to accept as presented.
Okay. Motion to accept as presented. Alan, second. Okay, any other discussion? All right, all in favor? Any opposed? Okay, passed unanimously.
Thank you.
I think you get the rest of the night off, don't you, Kobe?
Done.
All right, CWMU rule amendments. Mike, you're up.
Good luck, I don't order.
All right. So I'm Mike Wardle, Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator. I'll be presenting our recommended changes to the CWMU program, which is Rule 37. Before I get into the actual recommended changes, I want to just give some overall goals of what the CWMU program is about. The number one goal of the program is to increase wildlife resources. We do that by providing a monetary incentive for landowners through permits. And then also to provide public access to private lands for hunting, and then also to give protections to those landowners who provide the access. Now, one other thing before I get into the changes, I wanted to let you know that our recommended changes are not messing with the core of the program. The CWMU program is a very successful program and has been a really great tool in building partnerships with landowners. So we're not going to be recommending any changes to the type of species that can be hunted, acreage requirements, the comparable hunting opportunity for public hunter requirements, or the permit allocations. And with that, I will get into our recommended changes. So we input some wording to talk about agricultural damage, both within a CWMU and adjacent or next to a CWMU. So the recommended changes would require landowners and lessees who sign up for the CWMU program to sign a waiver that would release all claims for depredation assistance. The goal of the program is to provide enough monetary incentive that the landowner is being compensated for any damage that's occurring on their private land through the CWMU program, and that they don't have to go to the depredation program to receive that help. And then for damage adjacent to a CWMU, we would recommend, or our recommendation requires a CWMU to address in the management plan how they will avoid, mitigate, and if necessary, compensate neighboring landowners. Changes that deal with a certificate of registration or COR. So the current rule states that if there's a 33% or greater change in land ownership within a CWMU, their COR automatically terminates. We'd like to remove that from the rule. And also variance renewal. The current rule, the way that the current rule is written, it says that if a CWMU receives a variance for like a non-contiguous variance or a minimum acreage requirement variance, they would have to go back and get that variance every 3 years when they renew their COR. And that's very redundant. And we've removed that from the rule and given them the ability to not have to get that variance again as long as they are not making further changes away from the standard. And then we also put in some language that defines that CWMUs can only have one hunt boundary per CWMU. They can't have different boundaries for different species. We added satisfaction ratings as something that the Wildlife Board can consider when deciding to renew a COR. And then we also gave direction for our biologists in rule on what we should be considering when we're trying to determine how many permits to allocate for a CWMU. And these are items such as acreage and habitat conditions, management objectives, classification and survey data, depredation and nuisance conflicts, and then other factors too. Within the operation of a CWMU, we expanded the landowner association member definition to include any employees of the CWMU, agents or volunteers. This would cover guides as well. And then we also specified that management buck permits are only available for a CWMU if that CWMU lies within a management unit where there's currently a management buck hunt going on. So currently that is just the Paunsagunt and the Henrys. And then we also changed the wording regarding a muzzleloader elk season to match the standard 61-day season. CWMU would still be able to request a November elk variance, but the standard elk season would match the any weapon. And then we also inputted specific wording talking about hazing wildlife on a CWMU. We want this to be clear to CWMU operators, and so we put some pretty strong language letting them know that hazing is not allowed on a CWMU unless it's pre-authorized by the Division of Wildlife. And there are times when we need the help of CWMUs to mitigate damage to neighboring lands. And one of the most effective tools we have to do that is hazing. And so there are times when we give the ability to a CWMU to haze elk off of a haystack or out of alfalfa fields, for an example. Areas of a CWMU that are excluded from hunting, we want this to be upfront and in the CWMU application. So what this does is it tells an operator they cannot, you know, there are times when a CWMU will say, you can hunt the entire CWMU, but I have a cabin right here on this one plot of land and I don't want people hunting around that. And that applies to both public and private hunters. If a CWMU would like to do that, they have to do it upfront in a management plan. They can't change anything mid-season. Reciprocal agreements. So we put some more sideboards on reciprocal agreements. These are agreements between CWMUs that allow them to hunt multiple CWMUs with a permit. If any money is made from those type of agreements, the rule specifies what that money can be spent on. It's things such as biology, teeth aging, classification data. And we put some more sideboards requiring a deadline of August 1st. For any voucher donations, and then also written approval from the Division of Wildlife before any of those funds are spent, and an annual report too. And with the CWMU Advisory Committee, we spelled out what probation is and gave the committee the authority to place a CWMU on probation. Probation would simply mean that the CWMU would have to provide the committee a written plan of corrective action and report annually until they're removed from probation. I want to make it clear that any formal action against a CWMU would still have to go through the Wildlife Board. And then we also made a lot of technical changes and reorganized the rule a little bit. We tried to condense as much as we can and simplify. Anybody that's read legal writing knows it's not really awesome and super fun to read. So we tried to make it a little more clear and a little easier to understand. And that's all I have. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Mike. Any questions from the rack?
Thanks, Steve. Go ahead.
I just have a question on the depredation. Could you go back to that slide where they have to?
Yeah. It's the agricultural damage within a CWMU and adjacent to a CWMU.
Yeah, and the waiver release.
Uh-huh.
Releasing all claims. Can you explain that to me a little bit?
Yeah, so this is something that would be included in the in the CWMU application. Really, in practice, this is the way it is. If a landowner who's enrolled in the CWMU program calls the division and says, you know, I got too many deer on my property, then we say, well, let's handle that through the CWMU program. If you, as a landowner, are not receiving enough funds from the CWMU to compensate you for that damage, that's something that needs to be worked out. You know, lease agreement between you and the CWMU operator, or however it works with your.
So they would still be able to negotiate those compensations.
Right. Yeah. This is just saying that we expect that to be handled through the CWMU program and not coming to the division requesting monetary payment through our depredation program or something like that.
Mike? Does the CWMU have to gain authorization from surrounding landowners for hazing and that section?
Yeah.
And how do they gain that, and how do they, how does the division, how are you going to work that within the rule?
I don't know that we have a standardized process for ensuring that they've got permission. In most of these scenarios, the landowner wants somebody there hazing. I mean, if it's gotten to the point where we're asking a CWMU to haze, it's because that adjacent landowner has complained enough that they need help. And so our role is more connecting the two. I don't know that we would require like a written standard form of making sure they had permission to trespass or anything. I think we could leave that up to them, I guess. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I dealt a little bit with this last year on a hunt where a CWMU, which is authorized through a certificate of registration to hazed animals during our hunt, and it was not enjoyable.
Right.
So I worry that when we give the general public, a certificate of registration, formal permission to haze these animals, that how is it going to infringe on surrounding landowners? Because you might have a landowner that wants the animals hazed off of their property, but the guy next door doesn't want them hazed off of their property.
Right.
So and when you go to hazing elk, you know, it's they don't just stop and start where you want them to.
Yeah. Well, the one you're talking to was a little pretty complex, right? Because it dealt with another state, right? The hunt that was going on wasn't a Utah hunt. It was another state, and so there was definitely some complexities in that one. I think for the most part, though, 95% of the time, and really any time, if a landowner doesn't want CWMU hazing them off their property, then I don't think we're going to ask the CWMU to do that. In that scenario, there were other landowners that didn't want those elk to make it there, which is why that authorization was given.
Okay, any other questions? Alan?
Oh, go ahead, and then I have another.
How big of a problem is depredation damages claims on CWMUs right now?
Not very big. So since I've had this job, in the last year and a half, we've really only had one CWMU where this became an issue. So not really.
What I'm afraid of here is there's times like, you know, during the winter or early spring, CWMU has no ability to do anything about the number of animals on their CWMU that might come from wherever. I don't like that idea of making them sign a waiver on that, especially if it's not a big problem right now. If there's a problem that needs to be addressed on that, I think the landowners and the CWMU operators need to have the right to appeal for some help.
You know, I'm uncomfortable with that also for the very same reason that I think our timing is a little bit different. And you know, we may be in the early spring or the late winter, and the landowner's going to need some help. It would be I don't understand the CWMU, I guess, well enough to see how it could you could reach out to that for help. But the other question I have on the 33%, if the ownership changes by 33%, have any landowners been concerned about that? Because it seems to me like that could in some way hamstring a landowner from selling a piece of his property, or it reduces its marketability or market value. Has any of them made any comments on that?
So part of the reason that this was in the rule was that we didn't want CWMUs to inflate the market prices of land. We didn't want anybody selling a piece of property saying it's worth this much because it's a CWMU. Yeah, because a CWMU is not a guaranteed thing. It's not a property right. And so that was why this is in there. The reality is it's not come up. And so we just kind of felt like it was extra I guess.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll turn it over to the audience. Any questions from the audience? No, we'll move into the comment period. I don't have any yellow cards. Any comments, Larry?
It's over and done with now, Chris, but what I was asking for on the other, there was more public draw tags, but that's, it's over.
Oh, okay. Sorry about okay. that, Larry.
But anyway, on the CWMU, they have this regulation, $5,000 for the deer and $10,000 for the elk. I hope at some point in the future, I tried to bring it up years ago, that each acre and is not created equally. You can have 20,000 acres in Box Elk County and 5,000 acres in Kern Creek, and the Kern Creek property has more habitat on it than the 20,000 acres does. And so I hope at some point in the future that is considered for the CWMUs, because they're, it should be habitat. It shouldn't be acreage. So that's my comment there. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Larry. Okay, any other comments? Okay, I'll turn it back over to the rack for discussion, if any. Any discussion around Larry's comments?
Well, I would like to actually propose that we accept her thing with the exception of the a requirement for signing a waiver on depredation damages.
Okay.
I'd second that.
Okay, so, Alan, let me make sure I understand your motion. So, accept all of the recommendations with the exception of signing a waiver for depredation damages.
Right. Okay. Can I ask a question to clarify? So is the purpose of that waiver, so they're not essentially what would be viewed as double dipping, like they want to hold so many animals on their property to sell hunts, but then you don't want them to come back later and say, well, we've got so many animals on us, so you need to pay us.
Right. That's the other perspective of this, that in these cases, if we have a landowner who is profiting from wildlife through the CWMU program, we don't want them to be able to come and also receive a profit from wildlife from taxpayer money. When those funds from the depredation program that are paid out for mitigation payments are half sportsman dollars, half taxpayer dollars, and that's a really hard pill for our public to swallow when they say, look, you're already giving these landowners the ability to make money off of a public resource, and then when they have too many, you're also paying them for it too. And it does create a situation where a landowner can be incentivized to have a lot of deer, make money through the CWMU program, as well as put complaints through our depredation program.
When they sign up, when they sign their COR, does that automatically, will this go automatically go into effect, or is this going to be on a case-by-case basis?
So this would be, yeah, this would go into effect on their COR. I mean, it would be in their CWMU application. Yeah. But I don't know that, I guess it's in rule, but yeah. Yeah, it would be effect.
The time's up. Just kidding.
Yes. Got a comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Ben.
Mike, I think you said it exactly how I feel, that with the comment of the double dipping, I like the waiver portion of this rule. I think if we were to remove that portion from this rule, it goes exactly against what they're trying to accomplish. I can't say that I've ever given this much thought before seeing this, but I would agree with the DWR that if landowners involved in CWMU, in the CWMU program, that that's pretty significant compensation for most CWMUs, and I agree that they shouldn't be able to double dip on the other side of that.
And I totally agree with that. At the same time, I agree with what Alan's saying, though, is if a lot of animals are migrating in from other areas onto one CWMU, and they're not proper, you know, that's why I asked, is it going to be on every CWMU that signs their core, they're going to be held to this? And I don't know that I'm comfortable holding every CWMU to this, because I think there are many cases where animals they're not profiting from come onto their land to create issues.
Is there one thing on that?
Yeah.
I agree, but I think that in those scenarios, that can typically be worked out in a hunting lease, even if it's a year later, right? A lot of these CWMUs are made up of, there's a landowner and there's somebody who has a hunting lease on the property, and if that lease agreement isn't compensating them fully, that is a method for getting that compensation. And, you know, maybe they do have a weird year where they get a lot of damage, more so than typical. That is something that could be addressed. But that's my thoughts.
Go ahead, Steve. One of the concerns I have is, I understand the CWMU and the revenue generation to the landowner, and that is a good thing. However, when you start getting neighbors, for example, if you happen to be near a reservation and that reservation is very active in promoting their wildlife population, and yet they're not controlling their wildlife population, you have only a couple alternatives. The one is to fence them out completely with a large enough fence and a strong enough fence to get them out. Or you may end up having a real problem with those animals on your property. Being a case-by-case basis might not be a bad idea on this.
Okay. Go ahead, Alan.
Well, I think if there is depredation, and that's the reason I ask if there was problems with it, when he said there weren't really any. And so I think we're worried about something that's really not happening. But if there was a case, then I think when you make an application for depredation damages, those things could be looked at. Another thing, having been a previous CWMU operator, I can see a lot. We never did have any claims for damages, but I could see that the potential could come, especially early springtime when you get inundated by thousands of deer coming in onto an alfalfa crop or something like that. And I just think it's unfair to make them sign a waiver like that. I think those things, if there's a problem, can be addressed in the thing. The numbers, it isn't like the CWMU manager can set his numbers. That's all set in conjunction with the biologist and the DWR. So, you know, they're all working together.
Okay, thanks, Alan. So we've got a motion on the board. It's been seconded. Is everybody clear on the motion? Go ahead, Dan.
So let me see if this is a possibility. Isn't it possible for any weird situation like that to be presented to the Wildlife Board itself in request of a variance? Is that not, Mr. Wildlife Board? I'm just looking for a solution for a rare event.
And so currently there's no direction in rule giving them the ability to go. But yeah, the Wildlife Board meeting is a public meeting, so they could make that request for sure. I think it becomes difficult, though, when we get into a position of saying yes to somebody and no to somebody else. That can put us in a weird spot, especially when we're dealing with money and damage. It can be a hard thing.
Okay, so any other discussion on this? Okay, let's take a vote. All in favor? All opposed. Motion fails. Okay, I have another motion. Go ahead, Ben.
Move to approve as presented.
All right.
I'll second it.
All right, Ken, second. All in favor? All opposed. Okay, that motion passes. All right. Two opposed. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, move on to depredation rule amendments. Oh, excuse me, I'm skipping one. CWMU antlerless permit recommendations.
Awesome, thank you, Saul. I'll be presenting our 2019 CWMU antlerless permit recommendations as well. To give a summary, we had a total of 26 CWMU applications that contained antlerless permits received for 2019. Two of those were for new CWMUs. There was 11 renewals and 13 change applications. Just to give a refresher to everybody how the permit split options work for the CWMU program, you can see the two different sides here. On the left side, it shows the split options for buck and bull permits, and the right side shows the options for antlerless permits. When a CWMU signs into the program or when they do a renewal application, they get to choose one of those choices on the left. So, for example, if they choose the 90-10 split, which is that top one there for deer and elk, 90% of the buck or bull permits would be private vouchers, 10% would go through the public draw. If they choose that option, on the right side of this slide, it shows what they would get for antlerless permits. So in this... I mean, you gotta hurry.
Finish up what you're doing on the computers, save it to an external drive, and make your final selections in the library. If you have questions, please come on up the front and we'll help you out. Thanks for coming in.
I guess I'll hurry. So it shows that if they get antlerless permits, 100% of those go through the public draw. And what that's created is a lot of public opportunity on private land. This slide summarizes how many vouchers and permits we're recommending for CWMUs in 2019. The number I draw your attention to is that bottom right-hand corner of 1,145. That's over 1,100 hunters that will be given access to private land through this program. Before I get into the individual recommendations, I'm going to try and go through it quickly and just touch on the changes, on where we're recommending changes. And so I wanted to give some justification behind why we recommend increases or decreases in permits on a CWMU. A lot of times we're looking at wildlife distribution. As we know, wildlife don't distribute themselves evenly across the landscape. And we're also looking at any changes in acreage. There's times when a CWMU may actually reduce acreage, but they're gaining better habitat through adding another piece of land, and they have more opportunity that way. And we're also looking at quality objectives for that CWMU. These are limited entry opportunities. And then looking at unit management objectives. And then when we recommend adding a new hunt, it's because we'd like to utilize an available resource. So with that, I'll get into the two new applications. So in the central region, we had a new application for Mountain Sky Ranch recommending antlerless elk permits. There, this is just up Spanish Fork Canyon. In the southern region, we had a new application for a CWMU called Heist. This is out by Enterprise, and we're recommending doe pronghorn permits there. And we'll get into the renewal applications, and again, I'll just touch on where we're recommending changes, and if there's questions, we can go back. For the northern region, we're recommending an increase on the Junction Valley. Those are two doe permits for deer. And then we're recommending a new hunt on the Rabbit Creek for doe pronghorn. In the northeastern region, we're recommending antlerless elk for the first time on West Willow Creek Ranch, CWMU. No changes in the southeastern region for JB Ranch. In the southern region, we're recommending a decrease in antlerless elk on the grazing pasture, CWMU. Then we also had some change applications that came in. We met with a group of CWMUs. You know, Covey mentioned areas like East Fork Chalk Creek. It's difficult to manage private land, or it's difficult to manage elk populations with all the private land, and we rely heavily on CWMUs to help us. So we met with a lot of these CWMUs, and we've had a really favorable response. They've been really good with us. And so you'll see a lot of increases in the northern region for Deseret, Grass Valley, Clark Canyon, Mountaintop, Two Bear, and Weber Florence Creek. And these are all recommended increases for antlerless elk permits. And in the central region, we're recommending to decrease antlerless elk permits on the Heaston East. And then we're recommending antlerless elk on the Double R Ranch CWMU. In the southeastern region, we're recommending decreases for antlerless elk on Indian Head, Jump Creek, and Rome Cliffs, and then an increase in antlerless elk permits on Schofield Canyons and Spring Creek Dodge. And in the southern region, we're recommending to decrease antlerless elk permits on Pavant and Sign. And that's all I have. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Mike. Any questions from the rack? Buck?
Mike, I have a question. There are rules on how many permits they should be getting, right? How they come up with those?
As far as the actual numbers?
Yes.
We don't have, it's not like the Landowner Association program where we have a guideline based off of acreage. It's more, that slide talking about what we're considering. It's more of a conversation between the biologist and the operator sitting down and saying, what do you have on your unit? What are our management objectives for the area? What are our management objectives for the surrounding area? And what type of quality do we want to manage for on the CWMU? And I think it's good that way. I think it's better that way. I don't think we want to get into having a standardized way of recommending these permits, because every CWMU is so different, and every CWMU landowners are different. There are some that want to manage for extreme quality. There are some that want to manage for extreme opportunity. And I think in order for this program to be successful, we have to take that into consideration.
Okay, any other questions? All right, I'll turn it over to the audience. Any questions from the audience? Comments? All right, bring it back to the rack.
I move to approve as presented.
All right, motion to approve as presented.
Seconded.
10 seconds. Any other discussion? Okay, all in favor? Passes unanimously. All right, thanks, Mike. Now you're on to the game depredation rule amendments.
Now one more. All right, another rule change. This is for our big game depredation rule. This is a rule that gives us direction on our depredation program. And we're recommending some changes to some of the definitions. We'd like to expand the damage incident period to include our entire fiscal year, which is July 1st to June 30th. And then we'd like to, we inserted a definition for what we call a depredation mitigation plan. This is simply a document that we sit down with a landowner and fill out. It kind of outlines the actions that the division is going to take in order to prevent and mitigate damage. We also included a definition of what we consider an immediate family member. And you can see that there. We expanded the definition of a mitigation permit to allow a landowner's immediate family members or employees to receive mitigation permits. This is important because there are times when, we have a landowner who, say he has a big deer problem, but maybe he never took his hunter ed, he doesn't like to hunt, but he's got a son that likes to hunt, or he's got an employee that can help him. And then we also included definitions to describe what is considered to be a landowner, as well as a lessee. With pronghorn permits, pronghorn are doing well, mostly throughout the state, and this comes with increased damage. And so we're recommending to update the rule to allow two-doe permits in the depredation program. This is really helpful when we have a depredation hunt. There's a lot of times when we go to a landowner and say, we need to remove say we need to remove 20 deer or 20 doe pronghorn from your fields. The landowner says, man, I can't have 20 people running around my fields, but I could have 10. And this allows us to issue 2 doe permits and have 10 people, right? Yeah. And then we also removed some language that was in the rule that stated an individual could not possess a doe pronghorn permit if they had obtained a buck pronghorn permit that same year. Both these changes matched the changes in the big game rule. And we also spelled out basically current practice for the appeal process for landowners. And we wanted to provide more direction in the rule regarding stop kill orders. This is, so a landowner has the ability to issue what's considered a 72-hour notice, where they can legally remove wildlife causing damage after 72 hours. If it is determined that the value of that wildlife is greater than the damage that is occurring, the director's office has the ability to issue what's called a stop kill order. This spells that out in rule, as well as talks about the appeal process for a landowner.
The time is now 8:55 in the library.
And that's what I have. Thank you.
Testing your concentration, Mike. Okay, any questions from the rack? Give Mike a sec just in case. Okay, any questions?
Hi to Josh. Question. So by increasing to the 2 doe pronghorn permit, essentially that does take opportunity out of the public pool, correct?
Yes and no. So there are times when we haven't been able to do a depredation hunter pool hunt because the landowner wasn't willing to allow that amount of access, right? And this gives us the opportunity to have a depredation hunt because we can put more public members out there. And if, you know, when we have a depredation hunter pool hunt, we can't force the landowner to allow access, right? And so, in a lot of those scenarios, when they're not willing to have people on their land, we are limited on our tools, especially for allowing the public the opportunity. We end up having to answer or to solve the issue through mitigation permits or removals or other methods. But yeah, you're correct in that, you know, if we need 20 pronghorn removed, and we wanted to do 2 doe permits instead of a single doe, we'd be talking 10 people instead of 20 people. But we currently do this with deer, and it's been really helpful in a lot of these scenarios. The big thing is depredation hunts. It gives us more of the ability to do that.
Okay, any other questions? All right, turn to the 2 people left in the audience. Do either of you have a question or a comment? Okay, I'll bring it back to the rack for motion.
I'll make a motion to accept as presented.
Okay, motion to accept as presented by Ken. One second. 15 seconds. Okay, safe to bet no discussion, so go straight to a vote. All in favor? Okay, unanimous. Okay, last and certainly not least, Justin Shannon. Conservation Sportsman's Permit Rule Amendments.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Justin Shannon, and tonight I'll be presenting the Conservation Permit Rule Revisions. I realize I'm the last speaker, so I will move quickly. The first thing that we're looking to do is move to a 3-year program. The way that the conservation permit rule currently functions is we have a 1-year program and a 3-year program. And what we're looking to do is combine those 2 programs into one conservation permit process to simplify and streamline it. What we do is we would, by going to just one program that would occur every 3 years, we'd establish a single application process that conservation permit groups can apply for once every 3 years. We would define the eligibility requirements in the rule. Well, we have done that, and that's what we're presenting tonight. And we, if in addition to that, we would allow up to two new conservation organizations to apply for the program or to be accepted in the program each term. And if it turns out that there's more than two groups that apply, the two groups would be selected by a random draw. Again, the purpose of doing this is to simplify it and to streamline it, and also to ensure that all the conservation permits are used in the program. Right now, we have permits that are set aside for one-year conservation permit groups, and if there's not a conservation permit group that applies for those permits don't get used. We felt like we needed to define the process for new participants in the conservation permit rule. So what we're doing is new groups that enter for the first time would essentially be put on a probationary status their first 3 years, and they'd receive 0.5% of the market share, and that would come from all the other participating groups in proportion to their market share that they currently have. And during that probationary period, groups, they have to do a few things. The first is they have to maintain 75% of their market share. They have to actively market these permit opportunities and then complete all reporting requirements as specified in the rule. The division will be able to determine if a group meets its probationary requirements. And if it does, then it can continue on in the program moving forward. In addition to this, we realized the rule didn't have a good venue to address conservation permit organizations that might leave the program in good standing and want to come back. And so what we're looking to do is to give some direction on that. And so conservation organizations that leave the program in good standing, they may reapply during the next three-year term. And if accepted, they can participate in the program once again with the prior market share that they had before they left the program. And I've been talking about market share quite a bit. I'm not sure if I should probably define that. Market share is essentially the pie that is given for all the conservation permits. So if all the conservation permits that we had hypothetically equaled $1 million in value, and a conservation organization has 10% of that, or $100,000 worth of permits, that would be their market share, 10%. So I keep using that term, but I realize I didn't define it very well. Also, scheduling. We moved the. Currently, the rule says that all the deadlines are September 1st. And what we're proposing tonight is to move that deadline to August 15th. And so once every 3 years, conservation groups would submit their applications, and those would be due August 15th to us. And then annually, they would have to sell their permits, report, and transfer their funds to the division on an annual basis by August 15th as well. We wanted to strengthen some language and add a section here on obtaining and distributing vouchers. And so one thing we thought would be a good change is that vouchers cannot be purchased or redeemed by officers, agents, directors, or employees of a participating conservation organization unless those vouchers are purchased at 100% of their three-year average. The idea behind this is these conservation permits, the program is designed to raise as much revenue as possible to enhance wildlife conservation, and the goal is not to get a good deal on a permit, and so that's what this is for. Also, we wanted to clarify that conservation permits are approved in a separate process than that of the public draw permit. So like tonight, what you heard was a presentation on public draw permits for big game. In the future, you'll hear them on cougars and bears and turkeys and other things like that. And what we're trying to spell out is, as the coordinators bring out permits in the future, those are public draw permits, and then there will be a special meeting where conservation permits are proposed. And that happens once every 3 years. Also, we wanted to align the voucher redemption process with the electronic application. What we've done is, for every conservation permit now, it's all entered onto an electronic app, and it's all the data and information is stored there. And so in the past, we had language where you'd have to tear off the bottom end of a voucher, and we just don't have that anymore because they're not in paper form. We also are requiring that all the information is entered in the electronic app before a permit is issued. And so that needed to be added. Finally, we clarified that a person can obtain a conservation permit for both a desert bighorn ram and a Rocky Mountain bighorn ram in a single year, similar to what Kobe proposed earlier for the big game rule. And we wanted to strengthen our administrative enforcement language and a few other housekeeping items in the rule. So those are the changes I have tonight, and appreciate your time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Justin. Any questions from the rack, Dan?
Yeah, Justin. So as far as undersubscribed permits, I mean, Turkey's rule, right? I mean, that's probably where we're not using all of that opportunity. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's because those permits by rule are set aside. And then if a one-year group doesn't come along, that they're just not used for the conservation permit program. And so we felt like it just made more sense to, if we have conservation permits, let's use them and account for them once every 3 years instead of leaving them available and hoping a group comes along. So, yep.
Any other questions?
How many groups participate in the current program?
I think right now we have 7, I believe, maybe 6.
Often do you get a new group that comes in?
It's been a while. I've been in Salt Lake 5 or 6 years now, and I haven't had one come in. So it's pretty rare.
Yeah. Any other questions? Questions from the audience? Comments?
Sir? Jeremy Mueller Foundation. We certainly accept as you've explained it. One thing I would love to see, I don't know if it's possible, would love to see the division back up that 30-day payment again with our possible tag buyers and things like that. We are using that as our we draw the line and we say, 30-day payment. It'd be nice to have the muscle with the division behind us on that as well. As well as, I don't know if there's any recourse the division can come with as anybody that, say, purchases a tag for X dollar amount and then bows out of it and doesn't pay that. And so we have to remarket, resell. Be nice to see if we could do something with that person that did that. So that makes sense. Is there something in place already that I don't know about?
Sorry, I know it's the comment period, but I just want to make
sure. Go ahead, Justin.
I just want to make sure I understand. So what you're getting at is, say someone bids on a permit and you're at an auction and you give them, and so that permit is spoken for. So
correct.
And then down the road, they say, well, I can't come up with those funds.
Right.
You're looking for some type of, for the division to take some type of action towards.
Yeah, I don't know that it's, maybe I'm asking the wrong thing. I mean, maybe that's not what your part is. I guess, we're certainly going to blackball him from us. It'd be nice to know that he was, be some sort of recourse. It'd be nice to know that. Something for future thought, not to be decided or discussed, but
yeah, let me marinate on that and have a. I mean, I'm certainly not prepared to come with the response.
No,
but
we'll thank you
about it.
Thanks, Jeremy. Any other comments? All right, turn it back over to the rack for discussion or a motion.
Go ahead,
Ben.
Comment. I like what's been presented. Justin's done a great job. I do have a conflict of interest on this, so I will have to abstain from the vote.
All right. Thanks, Ben. Quick question, Justin. Is there a reason why we've backed off the 30-day payment period?
Yeah, it was just simply to try to get, what we're trying to do is get this information summarized sooner than later. And so we figured if a conservation permit organization has a banquet on a Friday night, it gives them the entire next week to get the information as to where that, the information of the person that was going to obtain that permit or that voucher, I mean, and just summarize it through that. And so we just felt like we could do that in a shorter window. And if the rack feels otherwise, we can certainly move back to 30 days. So,
okay. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Any other discussion? Motion? Ben can't make a motion, so.
I'll make a motion that we accept as presented.
All right, thanks, Ken. Seconded by AJ. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, all in favor? Any opposed? All right, that passed. One. All right. Thanks for attending, everybody. Meeting adjourned.
Easy. I expect we'll go later.